We'll start today's BPR with Professor John Bloom of Cornell Law School, an expert on the death penalty, as that part of the Tsarnaev trial begins today. And we'll continue the discussion we've been having with you about life or death for Jahar Tsarnaev. Then yesterday, it was the Boston Marathon. 9 years from now, it could be Boston 2024. Did anything happen yesterday that affects your view on whether Boston is ready for the Olympic Games?
Then Attorney General Maura Healey takes our questions and yours for her monthly installment of Ask the AG. Arts Editor Jared Bowen gives us a rundown of the latest arts events, from a sloshed William Shakespeare to a sober performance by James Franco and Jonah Hill. Then Nancy Kane talks about a CEO who is maxing out the minimum wage, giving his 70 employees a minimum $70,000 a year salary. Is he a champ or a chump? We'll ask you next on Boston Public Radio 89.7 WGBH. Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio 89.7 WGBH. Good morning, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. So as everybody knows, today the sentencing phase of the Boston Marathon bombing trial begins, and the defense team could be facing an uphill battle, much like the heartbreak hill that marathoners took on yesterday, in trying to get at least one juror to spare Jahar Tsarnaev's life. Joining us on the line to talk about what motivates a jury in such cases and what the defense team hopes to do to get a life sentence for their client is Cornell Law Professor John Bloom. John Bloom is the Samuel F. Leibowitz Professor of Trial Techniques and Director of the Cornell Death Penalty Project. He's tried more than a dozen capital cases. John Bloom, thanks so much for joining us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
John, let's start with we've gone through, obviously, the first phase of the trial, and Tsarnaev was convicted. His lawyer got up on the first day, as you know, and said he did it, so there wasn't any dispute about that. But how do they not just present their second case, the same case all over again, the prosecution with the victims and everything they already did in the first case? How do they make it different?
You mean what will be different about the prosecution's
yes.
case in
yes.
the next phase? I'm not sure that, I think it will be kind of more of the same. They'll probably try and go into the victim impact evidence, the impact on the, in more detail than they did beforehand. They might try and use more sort of documentary evidence like photographs and stuff. I imagine there's going to be some skirmishing about that between the defense and the prosecution about what level of detail they can go into on the victim impact evidence. But that's really pretty much, I think, what they'll have to do here. It's not like, you know, this was a person with a prior record and that, kind of thing. They may try and sort of, continue to paint. I think they will probably continue to try and paint the defendant as an extremist and whatever they have in that. But again, as you said, they've already sort of done most of this, the first phase of the trial.
So we'll spend most of the time with you, John Bloom, talking about what latitude the defense has, what you think they are likely to do to try to get one juror to change. But before we get into how much latitude there is, I think I read something you wrote or quoted incorrectly, saying while Judy Clark said and surprised most of us at the beginning, the one of his defense team, the one who has expertise in sparing her clients the death penalty, she said amongst her first words, "He did it." We read stories that the defense team approached the U.S. attorney in an attempt to strike a deal. They would plead guilty in return for the prosecution agreeing that the U.S. government saying that he'll get life in prison without parole. Did I read you saying that even if there was no plea deal, that it would have been wise for the defense to just plead guilty even without any promise from the other side?
No, I don't think I said that. If I did say it, I might.
Well, no, you probably didn't. You would know better than I. So when you were
I didn't say that. I think they. I agree with you. I mean, they have, clearly. This case is going to this. There was this trial, and it's going to the penalty phase because the government was not willing to allow the defendant to plead guilty in exchange for life without parole sentence. If they had, this would be over. I mean, it would still be over if they would agree to that. You've seen the reports that that's what some of the victims actually want to happen.
Well, that's what I want to ask you about, if I can. There, the latitude issue, the highest profile thing, front page of the Boston Globe the other day was Denise and Bill Richard, the parents of 8-year-old Martin Richard and his sister Jane. She lost a leg. Martin lost his life. Jessica Kinski and Patrick Downs, a couple of days later, who also lost limbs, said life in prison without parole is our preference. Does the other than whether they violated the judge's prescription about what you can do and not do when you're in the courtroom, will there be an opportunity, or is it relevant in testimony from victims to say, in addition to how this has affected me, here's what I'd like you to do, or is that not appropriate to be heard?
In general, most courts don't allow that one way or another. There's no, like, the Supreme Court of the United States hasn't, like, taken a position on this and hasn't said exactly what you can do. But the general sort of rule in the lower courts is victims aren't allowed to sort of ask for a particular punishment in one direction or another. Now, you know, some of that is the jury often kind of infers that from who they're testifying for and what they're testifying about, but they're generally not able to say, look, this was a really bad crime. This really affected, you know, my daughter's death really adversely affected our family. I want you to sentence this person to death. Or the opposite is in this case, look, this crime had an effect on us, but it's not going to help us to execute this defendant. That's generally not allowed. I doubt, you know, there might be some attempts in this case, but I think my understanding is the judge has also been kind of willing to limit that.
Well, you know what? I wonder even the mechanics of that. I mean, as Jim just said, the Richards family, the parents wrote this letter, said they didn't want Tsarnaev to die. So you would, but would the defense, because they're the defense, they're defending Zohar Tsarnaev. Is there, could they even call them? I mean, that's...
Well, they can call them for victim impact purposes, right?
But I think that's what right. I'm asking. That's what I'm asking. The victim impact usually comes in the prosecution side. You know what I'm saying?
Right, it usually does. And but it's not necessarily, you know, unilateral. I mean, it would be, yeah. I mean, I think what you're getting at is supposed to be a little tricky. What would you be calling them to say?
Right.
And I think, you know, on that, they could be called to talk about, you know, their loved one, and also to say whatever that they might could probably say they forgive him, you know, for what they do, or they don't hold a grudge. You know, these things kind of happen where you walk up to a line, and while you can't actually get them to give an ultimate answer, generally it's pretty clear from the line of questioning and what they talk about.
But John Bloom, I'm just confused about one thing though. Would that be part of the prosecution's victim impact statement, or could Judy Clark say?
They could call them. No, the defense could call them.
They could call them too,
or they could cross examine them, right?
And the Richards would they have the option to say yes or no, or just they have an obligation to show up if they're called by the defense?
I think they probably wouldn't call them unless they were
okay.
willing.
Okay.
You know, on that, it would be sort of, you know, risky and dangerous. It might be that, you know, is the government going to call them? I don't know. I mean, since they're not on the sort of, unquote, the government side here, you know, will they call them, you know, anyway and sort of, you know, let them, as you said, cross-examine them on this? I think some of this kind of remains to be seen, but I would not be surprised if the defense attempted to call some of these, you know, some of the victims, surviving family members or victims themselves who don't believe that it should be sentenced to death.
Okay.
Well, let's say, I don't mean to belabor this, but let's belabor it for one more second. Let's assume that Denise or Bill Richard or Jessica Kensky or Patrick Downs or anybody else who supports life in prison without parole as the option here is giving a victim impact statement for the prosecution. Judy Clark or whomever cross-examines them, asks the question, what would you like this jury to decide, even if it turns out the judge says you can't ask that question. By virtue of having asked it on the defense side, the message is sent to the jury, is it not? I mean, obviously a defense lawyer wouldn't be asking the question if she thought the answer was going to be, I want you to put him to death.
Correct. Right. And you know, maybe they'll get to ask something like that, and maybe they won't. Maybe the judge will limit it, maybe he won't. But there are a number of other ways to sort of for, I think, the jury to infer the same point.
That, like what?
You know, I mean, if the defense calls them, I think just in general, that's going to send some kind of message. You know, if they ask them, you know, is it going to help the healing process for you if he's executed? And they say no. I mean, there's a number of different ways to go at it.
We're talking with John Bloom, who's a professor of trial techniques at Cornell and also has tried more than a dozen capital cases to verdict himself. You know what else I wonder, too? If I were on that jury and I were wavering about death or life in prison, I'd want to know what life in prison was going to mean, whether I was going to wake up, you know, and see Zohar Tsarnaev giving an interview on Dateline NBC or something, or that he was going to write a book. Is the jury allowed to find out anything about what his imprisonment entails?
Yes. you know, the answer to that is yes. I mean, one, I mean, of course, the first thing you've got to make sure they understand is that it's truly life without parole.
Right.
Which it is life without parole. But a number of empirical studies have done have shown that jurors are skeptical that it is, in fact, life without parole when it is. So that's, of course, I think the number one thing you want. But, you know, the defense may call, for example, a former warden of a federal maximum security prison to talk about what the conditions are like in the prison, or to where he's going to go.
Okay.
To describe the fact that he, is going to be, what his conditions of confinement are going to be like, that he can't do some of the things that you're talking about. Because, you're right. I mean, some jurors have a misconception that life in prison is easy, you don't have to work, you have all your meals provided to you. Sometimes it's almost like they perceive he's being sent to live in a gated community.
Right.
Or something of some kind. And if they don't understand, that prison, federal prison, is really a tough, difficult place, it can affect the retributive balance, right? I mean, the jury's trying to figure out how much punishment is enough. And a misconception that about prison life can affect that calculus. So that's a good question.
We're talking to John Bloom from Cornell Law School. John, last night, Margie and I read something you wrote a couple of years ago, an overview of significant findings from the Capital Jury Project and other related kinds of things. One of the things you focus on is it's important if the goal of the defense is, again, to spare the life of their client, is the client shows remorse in some fashion. Clearly, the body language and behavior of Tsarnaev during the first phase of this trial suggested to most observers in the press that he didn't exhibit any remorse. In the penalty phase, other than Tsarnaev himself testifying, which virtually everybody says is unlikely, if not impossible, we'll get your thought on that in a second, how would the defense attempt to demonstrate that he feels any remorse for the four killings and the dozens of maimings?
They might try to do it through an expert witness who he's talked about the case with. Mm-hmm.
Don't you write, though, that the jurors in murder cases hate expert witnesses? Didn't you write that?
I do say that sometimes they don't like expert witnesses. I think when they don't like them, and what I was trying to get across there is if they feel like the case, what the expert's saying isn't really corroborated by other people that really had personal knowledge of the defendant. They feel like this is just some hired gun that they sort of brought in to say anything. Yes, that can backfire, on people. But if if it's supported by other, witnesses and people who have sort of on-the-ground knowledge and who don't appear to have necessarily a stake in the outcome, then they can be effective. But that's, one way to do it. We also, could it be through, people who've been visiting him, his other family members who have sort of been visiting him to talk about, his remorse for this, that's a possibility. Truthfully, I mean, I don't know if he's remorseful. And
Nor do we.
We haven't heard anything, about this. And, maybe in this kind of case, one of the things that's hard about this kind of case to talk about is it's kind of sui generis, mm-hmm. So when you're thinking about, well, what do we learn from the capital cases and sort of, what I would call kind of ordinary crime, it's not clear that all those rules necessarily apply, in a case like this where the dynamics are different. Where it clearly, was, regardless of where the radicalization came from, was, part of the sort of process of him being radicalized. And so it's a different kind of offense in that regard.
John Bloom, I have no idea, but I've been speculating irresponsibly since this whole trial began that one of the reasons he's shown so little affect in prison is because he does continue to view this as revenge for what the United States has done overseas and, one Muslim is killed and all that kind of thing. And also his message in the boat about how he idolizes his older brother. So I have this scenario that if his attorneys get up there and start talking about, how he's under the influence of his terrible older brother, whom he seemed in some ways, from what we know at this point, to kind of idolize, that you'll see the first showing of affect we've seen, where he'll be nodding his head in disagreement with what his lawyers are saying, because they're going to have to paint a picture of him being the compliant little brother with the big brother leading the way as the chief bad guy. But if Zohar Sarnaev doesn't think Tamerlan was the big bad guy, you know what I'm saying? It's a weird thing.
Yeah, it is. I don't have any answer to that. But, I mean, I don't think there's not any mystery that that's what the defense is going to do, right? They've been clear about that from the time Judy Clark stood up at the first, that gave her opening statement at phase one, where she said, look, he did this, and what we're going to try and do is sort of explain to you this process and how he became kind of like he is. I would be stunned if the defense strategy weren't consistent with what they've been telling this jury, that, yes, he did it. We're not, asking you to forgive him for it. We're going to try and explain to you how he got there through the influence of his brother.
So
their pitch, and I think it'll continue to be that.
So does that mean that Zohar had to sign off on that, or can they just do what they want no matter what he wants? Well, he would have to agree to this is how you're going to defend me?
No.
Okay, so they could ignore what he
wants.
No,
he doesn't have to agree to it. The Supreme Court has sort of have called this, a matter of sort of, trial strategy, and the implementation of the strategy. So he can't really, tie their hand. I want to be suggesting that he's – I have no idea whether, he has signed off on this or not.
Neither do we.
Their only obligation is to they can explain – they have to explain to him, this is what we're going to do. But even if he disagrees with it, they can do it anyway.
Okay.
But when you say they disagree on strategy, I want to be clear here, John Bloom.
I'm not saying they do. I'm saying
no. I understand if they do, but the bigger disagreement. For example, we interviewed Stephen Jones, who was one of the lawyers for Tim McVeigh, a couple of weeks ago, and as you I'm sure know, Jones was on his way to Washington to plead with the Attorney General's office to spare the life of their client until his client said, "I don't want my life spared," in which case he didn't go. If Tsarnaev wanted to be put to death, he could stop his defense team from trying to get his life spared, couldn't he, or could he?
No, I don't think so. Not at this stage. I mean, he could. His general option would be to, he has some, the client has absolute control over some things, like one of them is whether to testify. That's mm-hmm. the decision that he and he alone can make. Whether to plead guilty or ask for a trial is a decision the defendant, can make. But when it comes to sort of the presentation of evidence of witnesses, then no, they're not obligated to do what he wants to do. He could ask to proceed pro se.
Understood, by himself, representing himself.
To represent himself. That's not to say, different lawyers might take different views of this. Do you have, am I going to abide by the client's, desires or not, but no, I don't think you're ethically obligated if the client wants to die to assist him in his
The U.S.
Suicide.
I don't know if you know Carmen Ortiz here, but she's the U.S. attorney who has said repeatedly every time one of these statements come out from the Richard family or others, regardless of what their position is, some want him to be executed, some don't. She says, I of course take these into serious consideration. Once the Attorney General of the United States has decided that he, in this case, wants to pursue the death penalty, is that sort of the end of the ball game? Meaning if Carmen Ortiz, all of a sudden, having read these comments or heard them firsthand from survivors or victims' families, if she was really moved, does she get a second shot, bite of the apple? Can she go back to, as the Richards are requesting, go back to Holder, assuming Holder is still the Attorney General, and say, I've rethought this. I think enough of the victims and survivors want him to get life in prison without parole that we should just pull our demand for the death penalty. Has that ever happened?
It has happened in some cases where they've gotten into it where main justice has required, them to seek death. And they've worked the case out sort of, in the interim process. So, yes, I mean, the answer is she certainly could go back to main justice and say, look, we're ready to resolve this. The victim's family want us to resolve this. A majority of them do. And we think it would be best for the city of Boston and for these surviving victims' family members to bring this litigation to an end like they asked. Sure, she can do that.
You know, one last thing about this case, and I'd like to ask you, or you may have some questions too, but I'm dying to know about some of the cases that you've done. But we have, once again, speculated widely about how Judy Clark even got into the case and wondered whether the fact that she's renowned for helping clients evade the death penalty, this means that Tsarnaev has expressed that he does not want to die. So does his hiring of her mean anything or not?
I think what I have interpreted it to mean is that the federal public defender in Boston, who they don't have a lot of experience in capital cases.
By
most accounts, she's incredibly competent, an incredibly competent lawyer, but she sought out because understanding the magnitude of this case and the likelihood that it was going to likely be a capital case, they sought out the assistance of someone widely perceived to be the best, capital defense trial lawyer in the country.
Okay, so it has nothing to do with what Tsarnaev thinks about dying or not dying. You think?
I think we would be speculating sort of about. I think it really means that Miriam Conrad thought, I would really like to have Judy Clark help.
Yeah. Okay.
Hey, John Bloom, just a couple of final things. You've tried more than a dozen capital cases, as we mentioned, to verdict. Our understanding is in one of them, your client was sentenced to death. Is that correct?
That's correct.
One, was he or she executed? And two, what was that like for you as a lawyer to have to live through that?
So the client has not been executed. It sounds kind of whiny to say what an effect it had on you when you're not the person
sure.
to death. In that regard, obviously the person that it was toughest on was the person who we were not able to obtain, a life sentence for. And I think, at least in my mind, you always kind of go back in your mind and play it out and think, well, what if I would have done this differently? What if I would have done that differently? Because I believe that I believe that every case is potentially winnable. And sometimes every case, is at least have a shot to work it out. So I tend to think of it as, okay, what didn't I do that would have sort of saved, this client's life? And so you don't, at least in my mind, you don't ever quit kind of thinking about that.
Last thing for me, which is a step back from this, is this morning or yesterday I was reading the Washington Post story on this utter abomination that we're going to talk about on the show, this FBI over a period of years, thanks to the work of the Innocence Project, National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, found out that essentially, the vast majority of their experts on hair forensic matches have been cooking the books. And at least according to the Washington Post, in 14 of those cases where they cook the books, the defendant was executed. And while it isn't clear as to whether or not the hair match was the critical or one of the critical pieces of evidence against the later to be executed person, is there a case, is it not likely that someone like you or other people who do the kind of work you do are going to go to the Supreme Court or going to go to Congress and say there should be a stay on executions in this country until that has been resolved? Is it of that serious a magnitude, or am I reading this wrong?
Well, I think certainly, there should be any case in which any of this, evidence was potentially, offered. Yes, should be. Clearly be stayed and stopped and reviewed and probably have the death sentence vacated. I think the scary part about it is, it poses larger questions. I mean, at the FBI, who's widely thought to be sort of the gold standard in forensic science, was sort of, cooking the books on hair analysis. What was happening in all these little small-town police departments, and other stuff with not only hair but other types, of forensic evidence? I mean, we've seen sort of the erosion of the power of lots of different types of forensic evidence, which were commonly accepted, as reliable. And I think this is just another example that unless, somebody's watching this and somebody without really necessarily an axe to grind, that there's just too much of a possibility of what you saw with the FBI recently.
You know, John Blum, the FBI has been cooking the books around Boston for quite some time, as I'm sure you're aware. And a lot of us don't have a lot of faith in what they do. At least my faith has been kind of shaken. But I just want to ask you one last thing. I mean, you've obviously thought about this seriously, director of the Death Penalty Project up there at Cornell. Between, you know, the death penalty and how we all know it's often not fairly. I mean, a lot of poor people with bad counsel end up getting killed, and if they had better lawyers, they wouldn't be that issue. Then we read, Jim and I are interviewing later this week, the author of this piece about the Supermax out in Colorado, which I read last night, and it was like, I had no idea. This was like a 24/7 torture chamber. So you look at what we're doing with killing people was sort of maybe not the best of evidence. On the other hand, we're sending people to these Supermaxes. I think most of us really have no idea what goes on there. And you think about the power of the Bureau of Prisons. I mean, what do you think of the state of affairs in 2015 for people who face, no matter how horrific what they've done is, and everybody knows, obviously, this marathon thing was just absolutely beyond the pale. But this is pretty upsetting as well on the other end.
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree with you. I mean, I think, at least in my mind, the death penalty is a punishment that sort of has kind of outlived its purpose. I mean, we're able to protect society. We're able to incapacitate. And clearly, as you said, the conditions under which we imprison people are clearly sufficiently retributive and punishment to sort of balance the moral scales. But, you know, so given that and the possibility that we continue to see, right, of mistake. I mean, if you think about it, you know, if you look at the total number of executions and the total number of people who've been sentenced to death and exonerated, that rate is 9-1, that for every 9 executions, one person has been exonerated.
Wow.
If you think about that, you know, if 1 out of 9 planes crashed, who would fly?
That's a great question.
You know, nobody. And so if, you know, if we're convicting one person, and that's just the people that we know about. You know, there are other people who've been convicted and sentenced to death and executed, you know, like Cameron Todd Willingham, who almost everybody now says, yeah, you know what, he didn't do it. He wasn't exonerated. He's, you know, dead. Professor Jim Liebman wrote a great book about another person executed in Texas, Carlos Luna. So there's this possibility of mistake, and we continue to sort of see it, and this FBI lab's another manifestation of that.
John Blum, thank you so much for your time. We really
appreciate
it.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. John Blum is the Samuel F. Leibowitz Professor of Trial Techniques and Director of the Cornell Death Penalty Project. Thanks again, John, for being here. Coming up, we're going to ask you about the capital punishment system. Is it working? Should there be some comprehensive criminal justice reform before we execute another person? That conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Brady and Marjorie Ginn. If you're just tuning in, we've been talking about the sentencing phase of the Tsarnaev trial with Cornell Law Professor John Blum. But for the next few minutes, we're going to step back and look at the death penalty in a larger way. Blum, by the way, has tried more than a dozen capital cases. And he's convinced, as you heard, that the death penalty in the U.S., the time for it has come and gone, as it has in most Western democracies. Let me repeat what he just said 2 or 3 minutes ago. For every 9 people who are executed, 1 is sentenced to death and exonerated. 1 out of 9 or 10, depending on how you do your math, who is sentenced to death is subsequently exonerated. We mentioned this FBI thing that appeared in the Washington Post. There was an analysis of 15 years of FBI testimony on hair matches, and it was shown to be grossly flawed in 96% of the cases. And get this, 9 people have already been executed in cases where these flawed forensics were used. So should we have some serious criminal justice reform before we continue to execute people in this country? The number is 877-301-8970. Listen to this other case in this piece written by a guy from MIT His name is Eric Lander. It was in the today's New York Times. Three men from Washington were exonerated in separate cases. They'd served between them 70 years in jail. In each case, an FBI person told jurors that the defendant's hair matched hair at the crime scene based on microscopic hair analysis. One prosecutor in a case, and I'm reading from the New York Times, put the odds at perhaps 1 in 10 million that the hairs belong to someone other than the defendant. And the Times goes on to say, in fact, subsequent DNA testing found that none of the hair samples matched the defendant, and that one of the hair samples that matched absolutely was from a dog. 70 years in prison for these three people. It's unbelievable.
What they're basically saying in these pieces is that the forensic science is very unreliable, and it's not just about hair.
Mm-hmm.
It's also about a lot of forensics involving ballistics, you know, the weaponry and the bullets and all that. And they have this other
bite marks.
Terrible thing about this bite marks, exactly, where they said this. Mississippi released two men who been convicted of separate murders based on testimony that their teeth perfectly match bite marks on the victims. After the true killer was later identified by DNA, which is standing up as being reliable, mm-hmm. experts concluded that the wounds were not human bites, but most likely caused by crawfish and insects nibbling on the corpses. So they mistook human bite marks for insect bite marks. I mean, it's just kind of crazy. You know, we should just get this out of the way. The Tsarnaev trial obviously is not
a
forensic
different
trial.
Kettle of fish, right?
You know, everybody saw the videos. We all know he admitted he did it. We all know he did it. So whether he did this or not is not – he did it. We all know that. So this is a little bit different. But you are – the FBI,
but the vast majority
again,
death penalty cases are not as clear-cut, and they
yes.
don't have an admission from the defense counsel.
Think about watching this on television or reading the Patricia Cornwell books. She does all this forensic stuff. All these murders that are solved based on forensic evidence, and now you find out that if the Innocence Project hadn't come along to really look at what the FBI is doing, we wouldn't even know this.
Our number is 877-301-8970. So as Marjorie said, we're taking the Tsarnaev case out of the mix just for this one day, but obviously it's what caused us to even be thinking about this and saying, based upon these flawed forensics — flawed is an understatement — 96% of the cases they've looked at so far, 96%. By the way, this is the FBI, Justice Department, reviewing. It's not the Innocence Project, which obviously has a bias, even though I think it's one of the most impressive organizations in America. The Justice Department acknowledges when they're looking at 2,500 cases in 40 states from 1985 to 1999, they've so far looked at 268 of those cases. In 257 of them, 96% of them, the FBI testimony was fundamentally flawed. 33 of those cases, the defendant received the death penalty, and 9 have been executed. And while we don't know if they would have been found guilty otherwise, even without this testimony, it was a piece of the testimony that led to these convictions and, in 9 cases, executions. And when you hear what this guy, what John Bloom said to us a minute ago, for every 9 executions, there's one person sentenced to death who's subsequently exonerated, whatever that is, 10 or 11%, depending on whatever you do. I mean, is that rate acceptable to the American people, even if you favor the death penalty in the abstract?
You know, as he said, if one in every 9 planes was going down in flames, people would have a totally different — if one of every cars, one of every 9 cars, you know, the tires fell out at the stop sign, I mean, people just wouldn't. But we don't — the thing is, most of us don't commit crimes, so we don't come in contact with the criminal justice.
Doesn't affect us.
Al Johnson, longtime defense lawyer in Boston, used to always say, you know, nobody knows anything about the criminal justice system until they finally get into it for whatever reason. Then they just can't believe what goes on in there. I'm paraphrasing, but that's essentially what he's saying. And one last thing, I don't mean to dump on the FBI, but let me dump on the FBI and say that not only have we found out that their forensics were untrustworthy, you know, we do know that they exonerated themselves in what, 154 of 154 shootings.
100% of the shootings over a decade. 100%
of the shootings. They investigated the shootings that were questionable and found that they did the right thing. It makes you wonder how reliable that can be. And we all know that in Boston, about 35 years ago, the FBI knowingly sent men to prison for life for murders that the FBI knew they didn't commit. And as we all know, the Whitey Bulger case showed that the FBI went along with Whitey Bulger's, you know, career in crime because Whitey Bulger was very close to John Colley, an FBI agent, and other people within the agency knew that that was going on. So the FBI has a solid reputation around here. When you learn this, it makes you think, what is going on at the FBI. Our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970.
And this discussion is not it's fine if you want to participate in that fashion. It's not just about morality. It's about the ability to fix a mistake, whether the mistake was intentional, as it was apparently in a lot of these hair match cases, or just unintentional. You can't fix it when the person is been executed. You can fix it, as happened in these cases where these three men had served a combined 70 years in prison, and one of the 100% matches of their hair was with a dog. I mean, it's just, it is unbelievable. Now, luckily, they were not sentenced to death, but some, again, nine of these cases, well, people have already been executed.
It just makes you, I mean, all these things combined with what we've seen with police officers and shooting people and nothing happening to them, it makes you really stop and think about the criminal justice system. It makes you look at it much more critically. At least it makes me look at it much more critically, despite the fact that we all know, we need to throw in the caveat there, we always should say this, I mean, it is a tough job being a police officer. You just want the criminal justice system to be honest. I don't think that's too much to ask.
But you know what? We keep saying one last thing, but this will be, I hope, one last thing before the calls. We've said in all the cases, like, well, I guess most recently, Walter Scott, even though there are more recent ones, these are the outlier cops. Slager, in that case, they're the outlier cops. Well, these forensic witnesses
are not outliers.
96% yeah. of the cases, the testimony is cooked. 96%. The outliers are the FBI witnesses who tell the truth and don't hype the evidence, the accuracy of the evidence that they are vouching for. Let's start in Cambridge with Nicholas.
You're
first,
Nicholas,
on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Nicholas.
Hi, how are you?
Hey.
You're on. What's up?
I was just asking if this fellow goes to prison, will he survive in prison or will he have to be put into solitary?
This is
Sarnaev,
you mean.
You know, we don't know exactly what the terms of his imprisonment would be, but you would guess he'd certainly be in solitary for at least a period of time. But from what I just was mentioning before, this piece I just read about this supermax in Colorado, where he may end up.
The guy who wrote that will be with us Thursday, by the
way. Yes. I don't know if you can call it surviving in solitary because you are segregated from the general population. But what they were talking about in this piece is these people, these prisoners in these solitary confinement for 23 or 24 hours a day, basically lose their minds. So I guess physically they survive, or a lot of them are trying to kill themselves in jail. So, but it looks like that's the speculation, that he'll go to the most secure facility there is, and that's the one in Colorado, which is solitary confinement.
But Nicholas, can we step back from this for a second? The Sarnaev case, as we've said and as his own lawyers have said, is open and shut, not the penalty phase that just began today, but the guilt phase. When you hear about all these cases where people were sentenced to long terms in jail or to death, and in some cases actually executed, based upon intentionally hyped evidence by the government, does that not give you pause about the death penalty in general?
It's kind of sickening to hear that, isn't it?
I mean,
first of all, I'm against the death penalty anyway, but I can understand why it's being considered. But on the other hand, seeing all these people going to jail for 30 years being innocent or going or being murdered by us and the FBI, I don't get it.
Well, I have to say, nor do I, unless the only goal on the part of 96% of these witnesses was a conviction, not justice. It's really, the numbers are stunning.
Well,
Nicholas, thanks for the call.
Part of this has to do with the fact that it is very difficult to get information out of the government, period. And it's really difficult to get information out of the Bureau of Prisons. It's really difficult to get information out of the FBI. These things happen not in the sunshine.
And you remember Bill Keating? Bill Keating is the congressman from the South Shore in the Cape. He's on the Homeland Security Committee. He told us a story about how they invited the FBI to come testify in front of – this is Congress. And they said no, which is fine. And so they gave him a backup and they said, well, you can come testify behind closed doors if you're concerned about anything you say getting out to the public. What did the FBI say to that?
No.
No.
I mean, no.
It is almost like a shadow government.
But,
over which there is virtually no accountability.
But here's the thing. It's all linked together. Law enforcement is a big group. We have Maura Healey in here. She was a former prosecutor. She's a law enforcement person.
She is. She's the chief prosecutor
yes,
for the
she
state.
Is. So there's a certain mindset. You know, it's the FBI, the state police, the regular police in towns, prosecutors. Everybody kind of works together. And I think that's part of the problem, that they – they don't want reporters to get the information a lot of times.
Do you think most prosecutors want somebody to be convicted on the other side where they know the evidence is cooked? Most prosecutors? I surely don't. I'm not saying they're not some rogue prosecutors, but you think if they know that the FBI witness or whomever is cooking the books and the cooking of the books is the only reason that person is going to go to jail, you think most prosecutors want that?
I think prosecutors only take cases that they think that they can win. And I think that there's a lot of pressure to win cases. And I think that sometimes, with the best of intentions,
they'll do whatever they have to do.
There are T's left uncrossed. If they think the person is guilty and they think maybe not the prosecutors, but maybe the detectives investigating the case or the homicide cops or whatever, it's one big group.
And keep in mind, I don't know if this matters, that federal prosecutions are in our name, the people of the United States of America, and state prosecutions in our name as well. So they're doing this on our behalf, for lack of a better expression. Let's go to Boston. We're in Boston. Reese is on the phone. Hi, Reese. Hello.
Hi.
Hi. You're on.
I love your show.
Thank you.
Let's see. I think, you know, innocence is a strong argument against the death penalty, but I think there's a much stronger argument, which is, I call it the bad guy problem. Anytime we condone violence up to the death penalty, then it doesn't matter what the person did. We're sending a message to anyone listening or reading about it that it's okay for you to use that violence or killing against your bad guy. Now, whose bad guy are we talking about? You know, it just encourages violence,
yeah,
in my view.
Yeah, I hear you. But, you know, you were there before this. What we're looking, and we appreciate your call, Reese, what I'm looking for are people who support the death penalty, which obviously is their right, who say, this gives me pause. If I can't trust that the government's evidence is as reliable as they say it is at trial, and in case of these hair matches, 96% of the cases, it's, quote, fundamentally flawed, end quote, you wonder how people can say, well, it's okay to take a life when we know that there's a decent chance that this life was taken based upon faulty testimony and evidence. Reese, though, thank you for the call. 877-301-8970. What's the stat one more time? I just can't get over this number that John Bloom just said to us. For every 9 people executed,
one is exonerated.
Sentenced to death, but later exonerated.
That's correct.
1 out of 10.
Yeah, it's pretty scary odds. Anyway, we're talking about a criminal justice system, asking you if you think it needs reforming before we execute another person. That conversation continues on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Obviously, this is the day that the sentencing phase of the Tsarnaev trial has begun, and we will spend much time in the next several weeks, it's expected the last 4 weeks, discussing whether life or death is the right outcome for him. But we decided to step back after having spoken to the Cornell law professor, John Bloom, and talk about the death penalty in general. And we happened to talk to him just a day or so after the Washington Post published this review of FBI testimony in 268 cases between 1985 and 1989, 268 of 2,500 they're going to look at. And in 96% of those cases, 96%, the FBI testimony was fundamentally flawed. 33% of the defendant, pardon me, 33 of the defendants in those cases received the death penalty. 9 have been executed so far. And this piece that was in the New York Times, an op-ed by a guy from MIT, his name is Eric Lander, suggests that the forensic evidence, other than DNA evidence, which is virtually 100% reliable, is far from it. And he details people that have spent decades and decades in prison based upon absolute hair matches, when in fact the, quote, match was with a dog. Similar sort of cases where bite marks were, quote, perfectly matched, where the bites didn't come from another human. They came from, I don't know if you say crawfish or crayfish, and insects nibbling on the corpses. So the question is, do you want to be part of a nation that executes people, at least in some cases, apparently, based upon, I think this is a mild statement, intentionally cooked testimony that leads to imprisonment or death.
Well, I think what's surprising is that we didn't think it was. I mean, I'm stunned. I mean,
what do you mean? Didn't think what?
Until I read this thing from the Innocence Project. I read this and my jaw was down on the floor. Paul from Braintree, what do you think, Paul?
Hello, Paul.
Yeah, good afternoon. Good morning.
Hey.
It's a shame that Charles Dickens isn't alive today. I can only imagine what he would have written about the present condition of prisons and the like.
He was a great chronicler of the horrors back then, you know, that people put up with.
Again, this is, you know, it's Dickensian in what we're reading. I think the most important thing that the professor from Cornell said was that in today's modern age, we can really secure these people to keep the public safe. And I think that's the bottom line. And for those of us who profess ourselves to be Christians, I often wonder, as I look at the cross or the crucifix, depending on what you would like to call it, if Jesus were executed under modern conditions, and when you went into a church, and this sounds pretty brutal, you know, if you saw Jesus hanging by a noose, or an electric chair, gas chamber, on a stretcher, getting an injection, would Christians really be for the death penalty? I mean, it's a nice, clean cross, and in some Christians' faiths, they don't show Jesus on the cross, so that even takes it one step away. But it always occurred to me that Jesus was a victim of capital punishment of the day of the Romans.
Well, and you see that same capital punishment now being used in some cases by ISIS as well.
Well,
they've been accused of crucifixion.
But from those of us who profess to be Christians, I wonder if we reflected on the fact that that was capital punishment of its day.
Yeah.
Should we have it? Should we support it as Christians? I don't have an answer. But as long as Sanaev and the like can be secured out of the public, never to inflict their insanity on the rest of us until they die of a natural death.
Yeah, well, Paul, thank you for the call. I don't know enough about the polls on Christians and the death penalty. I know the Pope is obviously against the death penalty. I think you're supposed to be against killing if you're a Catholic or a Protestant.
Well, it's consistent with their position. It's hard to be pro-life.
Well, the Catholics talk about the seamlessness of their, you know, they're against abortion, obviously, and they're against euthanasia, and they're against killing people. So I suppose if you're Catholic, you're supposed to be against killing Sarnaev, although lots of people, you know, would say that they feel it's a justifiable death.
You know, the only unfortunate, well, I don't know if it's unfortunate or not, the fact that this FBI, this Justice Department investigation at the insistence or request of the Innocence Project and the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, the fact that it comes at a time when life or death is being decided for a guy where there's no doubt that he did the crime is unfortunate, because the vast majority of these cases, virtually every one of them, there's uncertainty.
Right.
I mean, ultimately, the jury found beyond a reasonable doubt, obviously, that they had done the crime. But there's not a lawyer standing up like Judy Clark and saying, I did it. There's not this kind of photographic evidence. Well, even if it didn't exist, she said, I did it. So these are cases which are determined based upon testimony and forensic evidence, which in many cases is phonied.
But think about it. You're on the jury, and the prosecution comes in and says, there's only 1 in 10 million chances that this hair does not belong to the defendant sitting over there in front of you.
Yep.
And it is certain. Ballistics tell us that we know that the bullets that killed so-and-so came from the gun of the defendant that's sitting over there. And we know that the bite marks of the dental records of the defendant match those of the bite marks.
Perfect match.
So you're sitting there thinking, well, you know, I mean, there you go. You got the hair, you got the gun, you got the bullets, you got the bite marks. So to find out that this is bogus, I mean, can you imagine how many cases this is the kind of evidence they use to convict people?
No, well, 96% in terms
of
the hair thing.
Them.
You know, you've mentioned, without giving the details, let me mention this Alabama case briefly that's in the same op-ed. Alabama recently released this guy from death row. He'd been convicted 30 years ago, 30 years of his life on death row. So not only away from his family for 30 years, but assumedly thinking, well, I'm going to be executed someday, which I think is a bit of a burden. He was convicted based solely on ballistics evidence. Alabama now concedes the bullets in question did not match the weapon that was used. They're not a match. So it's not a close question. They are not a match. This guy has spent 30 years on death row contemplating his own execution and being away from the world based upon, again, I don't know if this was a mistake or if it was intentionally cooked, but these are not aberrations anymore. They're not like every once a year you hear the Innocence Project and Barry Scheck or Peter Neufeld come up with a case that is just shocks the conscience. The numbers are stunning. Eddie, you're in Fall River. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hi, Eddie.
Hi, Jim.
Hi.
Hi, Margie.
Hi, Eddie. Listen, thanks for calling.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for your show. I love you guys.
Thanks.
Thank you.
I just really have a few testimonies. I'm not going to share them all with you, but not everybody in jail is guilty, and I'm sure you all know that with just what we're talking about today with FBI people getting it wrong most of the times. And they get away with their calculations and formulas every single time. There is a major problem with this, okay? Just in my city alone, Fall River, Massachusetts, where we are very poor here, it's most poor communities. It's hardly ever in a rich community, if you'll do the math on that, okay?
Yeah, you're right.
I think these police have to redeem themselves, or we have absolutely no reason to trust them anymore. And if you had a father like I do who's been arrested five times because of the color of his skin, you would only then understand what this is all about. My dad, five times, not once, twice, or three times, was innocent of any and all charges. But because he looks Mexican and Hispanic and he's from Portugal, but whatever, or if you're African American or just a poor person in a town like Fall River, we have no reason to trust the police here in Fall River. I'm sorry. And I mean, I know there's good ones, and I know a couple of them. Okay, but the few bad ones arresting us illegally for doing nothing wrong, breaking up our families, people, we have got to get together and get your camera phones out. And for all you police people that have families, think of them when you're mishandling us.
Eddie,
please.
We got to go. Thank you,
Eddie,
much
thank
for
you,
the call.
Thank you for the call.
You know what I think of and, before we
you
break
know,
here
bless.
Is Bill Evans, commissioner of police in Boston, who visits us once a month and talks about how tainted his own good cops are when a story like this arises. And think about it. Everybody distrusts everybody now because of this. But I'll tell you, as we've said, this 96% thing on the hair matches is really grotesque.
Okay, coming up, we're going to talk about yesterday's marathon. Was it a test drive for the Summer Olympics? And if so, how'd we do with the disruption and the traffic and the sort of bacchanalia that descended on the city, even in the rain? We're asking you about the marathon's test drive next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Off the noon hour for today's Boston Public Radio, asking you if the Boston Marathon was a test drive for the Boston Olympics, was it a collision course or a well-paved road?
Okay. Then Attorney General Laura Healey takes our questions and yours for her monthly installment of Ask the AG. Arts Editor Jared Bowen, he gives us a rundown on the latest arts events, from a sloshed William Shakespeare to a sober performance by James Franco and Jonah Hill, to an unbelievably fantastic exhibit at the MFA. Then Nancy Kane talks about a CEO who's maxing out the minimum wage, giving his 70 employees a $70,000 a year salary minimum. Is he a champ or a chump? We'll ask you. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. Welcome to hour number two of Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Hey there, Marjorie.
Hello, Jim.
So yesterday we asked you if the Boston Marathon and the training that all of the runners did inspired you to train for the 26-mile-plus race. And here's how one caller to our show, Simon, answered that question.
I couldn't get home from work this morning. A number of other people were being diverted. Basically, if the leaders of the city come can't run a world-class event without shutting down the city, much like they put us on lockdown during the Tsarnaev debacle, then really there's no place for having something like the Olympics here. Really, it may be good for our world standing, but really for residents of the city, it's a nightmare.
So our question to you is, does Simon have a point? Did yesterday's marathon make it clear the Olympics would be a nightmare for residents, or is Simon an outlier? Did the city succeed in serving both the marathon and its people? The number is 877-301-8970. Simon had made a pretty powerful point there, I think, but obviously there's special security in those sort of things. Well, I guess there's special security for the Olympics, too. Just to put it in context, by the way, the London Olympics had... We had one event yesterday, the marathon, admittedly mm-hmm. a huge one. London Olympics had 302 events. In the 2016 games, which are going to be in Rio, they're supposed to have 306 events with as many as somewhere in the neighborhood of between 20 and 30 a day. Now, not all of them would be in one spot, but of course the marathon is not all in one spot either. It starts in Hopkinton and comes here. So I guess, our question is, are there any lessons to be gleaned, good or bad, from yesterday's experience with the marathon that would affect how you view the possibility of the Olympics coming here in 9 years? And by the way,
it depends on where you live.
That's probably true. But by the way, a couple of weeks ago, as we said, we were expected to be joined for our first of monthly visits by the CEO, Rich Davey, of Boston 2024. They canceled right before their appearance. We are waiting for them to reschedule. And again, the deal that they asked for, actually, we didn't seek them out. They asked for was to appear here monthly. We are still waiting. I'm sorry.
Well, I think they're in the bunker.
Well, I don't know where they are. We'd love to have them, and we expect we will. 877-301-8970. So are there any lessons, any takeaways from yesterday's experience with the marathon that would translate into how you would judge whether the Olympics should come here in 9 years?
Well, I think the thing is, if you live around the usual suspects of streets, and the same streets are used over and over again, which is why you're always saying, I'm a crab about these things.
I
happen to
that.
Live on the street that's used over and over again, which is Beacon Street, not just for the marathon, but for all the marches and
walks for hunger and things
go through the city. And everybody wants, nobody wants to, you know, seem unkind about the Walk for Hunger, obviously, but it does. You know, the marathon, if you want to get from one side, if you want to cross over that road, you know, say you want to get from, you just want to cross Beacon. Mm-hmm. As everybody knows, it goes Beacon Street, goes out to Commonwealth Avenue, it runs into Newton, goes, you know, goes all the way out to Hopkinton where it starts. If you want to go across that long line, you have to kind of start in downtown Boston, drive out to Framingham, and kind of come back the other way.
Well, isn't that what that guy said he did or something like that? Route 2, I think.
Well, you
said.
Had to do it to get to England Cable News one day. And I, luckily, now I work on the right side of the marathon race because if I worked on the wrong side of this, I wouldn't be able to get home or to work either without driving all the way out to Framingham and coming all the way back. So if you're, you know, Commonwealth Avenue, Beacon Street, downtown, any place where there's going to be an Olympic thing, you better be ready to be inconvenienced, not just for one day or 2 days, but possibly for a month, Jim.
You know, by the way, also strengthen your argument. I'm trying to maintain some even-handedness here. Strengthen your argument. Yesterday was also a holiday. So the inconvenience that people lived through, assuming some were like Simon, was a day when there was less traffic, more people going to work, fewer people going to work and that sort of thing.
School vacation.
And that's a very good point, school vacation week. So obviously there may be more people in the streets or commuting and that sort of thing come the Olympics in 2024. 877-301-8970. Now, the flip side of that, by the way, we've told the story, but it is true. Do you remember when the Democratic National Convention was here when John Kerry was nominated?
I do.
Everybody was worried about the traffic, the this,
right.
the that. Essentially, the whole town cleared out. Marjorie and I, we both have told you the story of walking to and from, I don't know what the garden was called in those days, the New Garden,
the
New
Fleet
Boston
Center,
Garden,
then?
Whatever it was. There
Bank.
Were only three kinds of people that you would see on the streets. Cops, media people, and delegates to the convention. Literally, you would see no real human beings. And by the way, well, that was fine on one hand. The flip side of that, and that was only for a handful of days, is all the businesses that said that believed that they were going to have record numbers of customers in. And you know, with all due respect to the late, great Tom Menino, he really did scare people out of town. I mean, he did such a good job that essentially everybody got out of here. But I don't think most people want to leave town for 3 or 4 weeks come the Olympics. So the question is, can the citizenry of this community, Greater Boston, coexist with the biggest international sports festival in the world? By the way, nobody would suggest there's not going to be some inconvenience. The question is the level of inconvenience something that people are willing to tolerate in return for which they get the most heralded sports games in the world?
I think you better start renting your little cottage up in Maine right now just to be sure you have a place to get to, because it will be in the summer and it will be for a long time and the security is going to be massive.
This is
a worldwide event. So, you know,
the
security that we had for the marathon yesterday is going to be teeny tiny in comparison. Didn't we look out the window of the TD Bank and see, didn't they block off part of the expressway?
I can't remember.
Wasn't it closed?
There were
no cars on it. I do remember this, though. And we talked about this with Commissioner Evans, how he doesn't like the cops to wear riot gear because it's so scary. Remember seeing those lines of cops in riot gear, how scary it was? You walk out of there and you see them with those plastic like shields they have and the helmets on. You think, God, I better not drop a gum wrapper here. I might be like, you know, beaten to a pulp.
877
scary.
301-8970. The question is quite simple. Did you learn anything yesterday, good or bad, that affects how you view the possibility of an Olympics coming here in 2024? Let's start in Worcester with Tim. Tim, you're first or next or whatever you are on Boston Public Radio. Hi, Tim. Hello, Tim.
Can you hear me?
Yeah,
yes.
Sure.
Yeah, actually, I'm from Marblehead. But I lived in Los Angeles during the 80s when the Olympics were there.
Oh, how was that?
It was awesome. I mean, I drove for a living, so... I mean, in my job, I had to do a ton of driving. So I was in my car 2 or 3 hours every day. And when the Olympics came, it was like everybody had left town. I mean, you could get anywhere in, you know, half the time. There were all kinds of free tickets to events. I mean, I saw women's volleyball and all these things. I don't know. It was just really fantastic.
So where did everybody go?
I have no idea, but... I think, you know, like Menino scaring them out of town, they were scared out of town, you know, Los Angeles of all places. And it was, driving was a dream for those 2 weeks.
Do you remember when you saw the women's volleyball? What were they wearing back in 1980 in the Olympics?
Like
Were they wearing the bikinis then, or were they dressed a little bit more?
The short shorts.
Which, frankly, they should go back to. I'm
so
not a purist, but it is foul.
Amazing that they could play volleyball in the short shorts back in 1980, but now they have to be in bikinis.
I know.
Hey, Jim, thanks for the call. So essentially, based upon what Jim said, having driven around L.A. during those Olympics there, is Boston 2024 should say something like, don't worry, we're going to scare you all out of town anyway. I mean, I thought when he said the driving was easy, he was going to say, actually, it's much better than you think it is. Mm-hmm. What he was saying is that virtually everybody who lives there disappeared, and so it was easy to get around.
And you know what? The Olympics themselves are 2 weeks, right?
But then
you have the preparation to the Olympics. So we're talking what?
Month or two.
4 weeks, maybe a couple
Six
of months.
Weeks, yeah.
Could be the entire summer, Jim.
Well, it is the summer.
You know what? We may have to have school in September.
Yeah, but can I tell you something?
If the Olympics are still here.
My concern is less the inconvenience. I know that's yours, one of yours. My concern is all about the money. It's all about what the bottom line is going to be. You would, if all the financial things were taken care of to your satisfaction, mm-hmm. you wouldn't be willing to endure a couple of weeks of personal inconvenience to have the games here.
I told you what my
I know
my
you want the
is.
Tee fixed.
I want the MBTA fixed. If they can tell me they're going to fix the tee, then
you deal
then
with
I'll
the,
change
you
my
deal
mind.
With the inconvenience. If they
yes,
fix
I will.
The tee.
I might even pay more money to fix the tee because I think that's a big problem. Christopher's got a good point too. He says maybe I can rent out my house to some Slovenian volleyball players.
Oh yeah,
make a lot of money.
It's huge money.
Yeah, that's a thought too. That
oh, by the way, there's no question that if you want to rent your house, and well, I shouldn't say no question. The conventional wisdom is that you can make a ton of dough if you want to rent your house or apartment out for the couple of weeks
of
the Olympics.
Is, where do you go?
Yeah, exactly. It's a very. Let's go to Marshfield, where John is on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, John.
Hey Jim. Hey Marjorie.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you doing? Good.
To the point of renting your house out, it never happens.
It doesn't.
After the World Cup. Can anyone relate a story of some Nigerian potentate coming over to rent the house?
Actually, he rented mine. I forgot. I didn't want to talk about it, but he did, or she did, or somebody did.
My point is, I was watching the marathon yesterday, and I was watching as the women runners, I was watching on TV, watching as they go through Cleveland Circle. When I was 30 years ago, when I was a kid, we used to always go to Cleveland Circle, cheer the runners on. It was awesome. You know, the runners probably had like a 20-foot-wide path to go down. People were cheering. It was fun. Yesterday, their security grades up. They get the full roadway. The interaction's gone. If you saw the runners coming down Boylston Street, there was a cop every 3 feet. You might as well have the Olympics or the marathon at the Pheasant Lane Mall, because the human-urban interaction is gone. And you can say that, well, they did set off bombs, but you got to remember, those two guys from Cambridge set off those bombs. There were cops everywhere.
Yeah. You thought that was over, too much security?
There's too much security. Do you remember, you were talking about the convention. I remember there was some protest on bicycles, and I was downtown, I was working on High Street at the time, and the police came through like, I don't know, like the Pope, the Emperor from Star Wars, and the President was coming through, and it was just a bunch of kids on bikes protesting. It's just ridiculous.
Well, do you remember the fenced-in
cages.
Area for protesters?
Yeah.
The cages for protesters, yeah.
Yeah. That's where you had to go to protest, was cages. You know, it's a tough one,
by the way, that's
one,
where
though.
They're thinking of putting most of the residents of Boston during the Olympics.
That's right.
During the Olympics.
Little cages
and,
by
I'm
the
kidding.
Waterfront.
If Boston 2024 is listening, I'm actually being facetious.
But,
John,
you know,
thanks for the call.
It's a tough one, though, because if something were to happen
again. Of course,
again,
you need a lot of security.
Then right away they'd say, hey, you didn't have enough cops. You should have had cops every 3 feet. So I don't know. I don't envy the Boston police in this one, because it's a tough situation. I mean, I know people were complaining it took too long to get through the checkpoints. But if someone had gotten through the checkpoint with something and done something bad, then they would have been on the hook.
Those who are complaining. I mean, Philip Martin called us yesterday and said a bunch of people were complaining in and around Boylston Street about that. Do you think they're the outliers? I mean, in a situation like this, 2 years removed from that atrocity, the fact that it's not like an armed camp, which is one of the things that William Evans, the commissioner, says he doesn't want it to be, the fact that it isn't that is a step in the right direction. So that part of it, I think they're doing an extraordinarily good job. The problem is security for an Olympic Games, when athletes from all of the same countries and even more are going to be here, is going to be epic.
Well, don't you
remember?
It's
a homeland security event, as we've learned, so the feds have deep involvement. There is going to be a huge – and it's a little town. I mean, that's the thing. When people talk about Los Angeles, I thought the guy where that guy was going was not – the guy who called a few minutes ago was not the notion that it was easy to drive around because everybody left town, but because Los Angeles is a sprawling community. This is a tiny community, much tighter, which is one of the reasons I love it. It's walkable and that sort of thing. But the potential for it to be a much denser experience is concerning. But I assume they'll answer that question too.
Bob in Boston. What do you think, Bob?
Hi, Bob.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello
there. Yes, I just wanted to say that to the point Marjorie made about fatigue, I think it's absolutely essential and critical to have that up and running, a state-of-the-art 100% ready to go if the Olympics were ever to come. But the problem is that's going to be part of the rejection of the Olympics in this town, because people do not want to pay through the nose for it. There's creative ways in which you could deal with getting these things taken care of, but apparently the State House never wants to entertain those types of things. For example, If you had companies and corporations are so excited about having the Olympics to come to Boston, so why don't we ask them to adopt a tea station and have the thing renovated? They can keep the name on it for 10 years. They can help with half of the money to pay for the renovations of the station, and ultimately they get their name out there and their sponsorship. They have an advertising thing for 10 years, and things get done. But I think as things go right now, paying for the tea to get done is going to fall on the taxpayers' shoulders. And that's going to be a negative towards the Olympics.
Bob, you know, by the way, I haven't read the whole task force report, but that kind of creative revenue raising is the kind of thing. I don't know if it's naming rights as such, but a variation on what you're talking about is what they are talking about. And by the way, Mike Astor, who was with us yesterday, wrote a piece in the Herald, I think on a similar vein, that there are lots of potential for revenue raising that don't involve the taxpayer that should be considered by those who are now in charge of the T. Bob, thanks for the call.
You could rename the T stations.
Yeah,
the John Fish Suffolk Construction.
Well, except
Copley Square could be changed.
Well, I was about to say, do you remember Rich Davey was Secretary of Transportation?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm assuming we'll get this right. And if not, I will ask him the question when he gets here someday. He's now a CEO of the Boston 2024 Committee. I believe we asked him after they had put up for bid a ton of the T stations for naming rights. And I believe either he or Bev Scott told us that virtually nobody had bid for these things. Maybe there was one. I'm not sure.
No.
Actually, if one of you guys in the control room can check that, how did the naming rights thing that the T attempted a year or two ago go? My recollection is there were virtually no candidates. But it'd be different if it was around. Well, whatever. It depends what the price was worth. I don't know.
Well, I suppose you'd only want to be named. I mean, I suppose it would depend on where the station was. You know, if it's a really nice station like the Copley Station, where it's like right in the middle of town, mm-hmm. government center, I guess.
Well, obviously, the less advantageous sites are going to cost you less, too. So you pay more to get a better site.
Know. Would you want to be a station in Quincy named after you, a Braintree, Jim?
For me, I'd love it. Anywhere they'd like to name a station after me, I'd be willing to do. 877-301-8970. Our question that came to us as a result of what a guy, Simon, who was a caller yesterday, said, I couldn't get home from work this morning. Really, he says, there's no place for having something like the Olympics here. Maybe good for our world standing, but for our residents of the city, it's a nightmare. We wanted to know what your reaction was to yesterday and if anything that happened yesterday colors your perception as to whether or not the Olympics coming here in 2024 is either a good or bad idea.
Let's go to Joe in Boston. Hi, Joe.
Hello, Joe.
Hi.
Hi.
You made a comment a couple of moments ago saying that it would only be a four-week inconvenience during the Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody is talking about the inconvenience for 4 or 5 years during the construction of
it. That's a good point.
That's right.
My son lived in Salt Lake City. He still does when the Olympics came there. And I happened to go there, and it was a nightmare out there with all the road construction, the venues being built. And everyone that I know there, still to this day, people I know out there personally, wish the Olympics had never come to Salt Lake City.
And, well, there you go.
So, you know, I guess it depends on the, you know, perspective. Also, just want to point out that the expressway was closed down during the DNC.
Yeah, I thought
it
so.
Was.
I remember standing in the window and seeing the empty expressway, and it was so eerie and weird to look out and see just nobody going in either direction.
Now, that may be, I don't remember it, but you and Marjorie seem to, that may be because 93 is right next to the whatever the garden is called at that particular time.
For security concerns.
Right, exactly. So it was right by there. But
Joe, thank you. Thank you for the call. Let's go to Jim.
By the way, before you go ahead, our colleagues looked this up.
Yeah.
Last year, the T received only one bid for naming rights. It was from JetBlue.
Oh, no.
But JetBlue didn't want to pay the money required to do it. They wanted to rename. Oh, this is actually pretty clever. They wanted to rename the blue line. I assume they wanted to call it the JetBlue line. So the answer is when they put T stations up for naming rights, they sold none. So that was a great idea the caller had a minute ago, and we liked it, but apparently, at least historically. And by the way, the irony of this is the same guy who's running Boston 2024
uh-huh.
is the guy who was the Secretary of Transportation, and before that, the head of the T during this naming rights thing. And we, again, we'll
do maybe they need to lower the price, Jim. Maybe we were too ambitious.
And by the way, I'm being somewhat facetious. I'm pretty convinced that they are eventually going to do this monthly thing with us, or at least make an appearance, and they are welcome virtually anytime.
Jim in Wareham, what do you think, Jim?
Hello, Jim.
Hi. Thanks for accepting my call.
Sure.
Every place the Olympics has gone, I mean, look at Greece. Everybody's left in deep debt. Massachusetts hasn't got that much money as it is. It runs a deficit all the time. Boston is not made of gold. And this event benefits the whole country. Why shouldn't the federal government foot the bill? And why do we need the Olympics to upgrade the T?
Well, two answers. One, the federal government is theoretically paying for all the security. That doesn't mean all the costs, but all the security. Number two, what was your second question?
Oh, My second question was, why shouldn't the T foot the bill for everything?
Oh, well, I can answer the question, because for 25 years, to quote David D'Alessandro, who did the study in 2009, the legislature has been kicking the can down the road, meaning not really fixing it. And the argument, I'm not endorsing this nor criticizing it, the argument from the sponsors of the Olympic bid is, we will be the leverage that will finally get, because there'll be a deadline, we'll be the leverage that finally gets the legislature to do what needs to be done to get the T fixed. I have no idea if that's true or not. That's how the argument goes. And by the way, it would be persuasive to Marjorie if what was going to get fixed was far more than Rich Davey told us last time he was here was going
to
be fixed.
Next to nothing.
Which is very little.
And one of the things that's encouraging to people that are worried about the money is this report that does say, even though everyone agrees that more revenue or tax dollars is going to be needed eventually, is that there is a lot of mismanagement of the T. That, you know, if they can get control under the amount of time people have taken for vacation and sick days and abuse of these different leaves, and they can maybe repair some of the T trains without going through, I mean, apparently it's very expensive to do it the way they're doing it now. So there's a lot of ways to save money. So it means that the bottom line may not be quite as astronomical as we thought of if, you know, we were running an operation that was efficient right now, which apparently we're not.
Jim, thank you for the call. 877-301-8970. We were inspired by a caller yesterday, Simon, who said yesterday was a nightmare and the Olympics would be an even greater nightmare. Is evidenced by what happened to him yesterday. He couldn't get home from work. Traffic was diverted, all that sort of stuff. And again, that was one event. And the average Olympics, Summer Olympics, has 300 and some. And as many as 26 to 30 go on at the exact same time. Would that suggest to you that the traffic and other sort of logistical things potentially are nightmares? So let's go to John in a car. You are next on Boston Public Radio. Hey, John.
Hello.
Hi there.
I'm a listener, first-time caller.
We love both those things. Thank you.
Yes. Just a general comment. So I'm a transplant to the Boston area, and I couldn't imagine anything worse than having the Olympics here. If you pick any single event, if you're just going to the Cape, the Topsfield Fair, singing apples in the fall, just you realize the logistical nightmare that happens. It's ridiculous. I can't imagine having 300 of those go on over a four-week period. It would be absurd.
Yeah, John, I hadn't thought of the bridge to the Cape, but can you imagine if an event or two was in Hyannis, for example?
Hold on. I remember about when did IKEA come to town? Like 5 years ago or something?
I think a little bit more.
Whenever it came, when the IKEA store opened, John, I went down to do a story on it when I was working for the Boston Herald then. And we were backed up on the highway for like 3 miles for the opening of the IKEA.
How about Black Friday
store
at that mall? What's that mall called in? The Wegmans thing too.
Oh,
Rentham.
Wegmans.
The Rentham Mall.
It's a shopping center, for God's sake. And
that's right.
For weeks.
Yeah.
I can't imagine worse.
Well, John, you said you're a transplant. How long have you been here?
6 years.
You've been here six years. You're actually going to have to leave in 2022 if the Olympics come in 2022. John, thank you for the call. You know, those are pretty powerful arguments. What would Boston 2024's response be to that? Black Friday,
know.
They're lined up for 4 hours on whatever the highway is that leads to Rentham. Same thing with Wegmans. That's true when it opened. Getting to the Cape continues despite the flyover. And good for Mitt Romney for doing that.
Nothing.
You're not flying over anytime.
You are not flying. You know what's hysterical? When you're sitting there coming home sometimes in the Mid-Cape Highway, heading toward, and you're not going anywhere, you're like going 1 mile an hour, and you see the big blue evacuation route signs,
yeah.
And you think, you know,
exactly.
Why do we even bother? If we need to evacuate, we'd all be dead by now. I mean, it's just crazy. Just sitting there in traffic. So that is a very good point.
What was the day that Deval Patrick either urged or required that businesses and government close early? Do you remember that day?
Yes, right before Christmas.
Yeah.
It took me 4 hours to get home from Dorchester.
Do you remember
to
what I couldn't do that night? I would leave. We were then a morning radio show on our other radio station. We were done every morning at 10 o'clock.
Yep.
I was on TV live at 6 o'clock,
right.
Which is 8 hours later.
You didn't make it.
I didn't make it. 8 hours. From Morrissey Boulevard to in Dorchester to Newton, 8 hours I could not make it to NECN.
I think we have a solution, Jim.
What is that?
I think if the Olympics come to town, everybody's going to have to get a Segway, one of those little machines, and they can ride. You ever seen those Segways? Of course you have.
I've ridden
them. You're the star of the Segways. I think that we'd all look very cool Getting About Town in little segues.
By the way, for those who say, when you hear Marjorie say I'm a star of the segues, let me just tell you very briefly before we get back to the Coles. There's a, I think the movie is called America at 15 Miles an Hour. And these young guys made a movie at 15 miles an hour, I guess, is what a Segway maximum speed. And they came out to NEC and I interviewed them. And before I interviewed, they were in the middle of making the movie. And in the middle of it, they said, do you want to ride a Segway? And so actually, it is huge fun. It is really huge fun. I rode around the parking lot. It was perfectly fine. And it's as easy to operate. And you learn as quickly as they say. But then they said, why don't you try it in the newsroom? So I try it in the newsroom. It's a little harder to manipulate when you haven't done it before, between the desks and that sort of thing. Well, it turns out the camera, they were filming me not only from behind, but from below. So my part, and I use the term advisedly, in the movie was a rear shot, and I mean that literally, from below, riding a Segway through the newsroom at NECN. 877.
Poor Mr. Segway.
What's that?
Poor Mr. Segway. The story of the guy that invented the Segway?
Yeah.
What happened to him?
He segwayed off a cliff in Great Britain. He did. Marjorie, it's not amusing. It's not amusing. Let's go to Mike in Boston. You are next on Boston Public Radio. How are you, Mike?
Good. Hey, Jim and Marjorie.
Hey there.
If the Olympics could improve public transportation at all, then I'm definitely for it. I'd love to be able to get to downtown from downtown Boston where I work to Blue Ribbon Barbecue in Arlington.
Mike, are you the guy who's you and his father I met yesterday?
Yeah, who bought you lunch yesterday at Blue Ribbon.
Terrific. This is a reverse generation. He didn't buy me lunch. This is a reverse generational thing. This
Mike
young
says he bought you lunch.
No, he did not. I asked him to buy me lunch. He refused. So Mike and his father introduced, usually it's the father who's saying, I'm trying to convince my kid to listen to your radio show. What did you try to do, Mike?
I'm trying to get him to move from one radio station that I won't name to listen to you because I think it makes people happier to listen to you.
Mike, you are the man. So, Mike, now
I've
that
I've got a couple of young people listening right now to me calling. So.
I love that. Now, Mike, now that we know what kind of wisdom you have, even though you unwisely chose not to buy me lunch yesterday.
I offered.
What's your take on an Olympics coming to town? You're, if I recall, you're a young lawyer who works downtown. Yeah. How do you feel? How do you feel about that?
I would love it because I live outside of Boston, and I have, especially over the past couple of months, it's been impossible to get into downtown Boston. So I completely agree with people who believe that, if we don't spend a lot of money on it and if there's no public funds going other than public transportation, then I don't see why it could hurt.
Now, Mike, let me tell you the quandary that Marjorie's in. I've known her for a long time. She's deciding whether or not she should trash you. But when she realizes...
I've been listening to her all the time. And, Marjorie, I appreciate your concerns, but I think you need to be more open about it.
Okay.
Mike, you said it beautifully. Say hi to your dad, Mike. It was a pleasure to meet you yesterday. Thanks so much.
I was trying to get open about it, but then Christopher just emailed about the traffic at Gillette every Sunday.
How many
events do they have in Don Gillette?
You and I got tickets from our former radio station. We went to opening day a couple of years ago. And, by the way, it only took us like 7 or 8 hours to get home. That wasn't bad.
Coming up, and we parked about a mile from the stadium too. We had to walk a mile in each direction.
You know what we can do? I'm just trying to be Segways, more open-minded, as Mike just suggested. Maybe we can just sleep in the newsroom for a couple of months.
Okay.
By the way, we continue to say we are waiting for Boston 2024 to join us anytime. Just give us a buzz.
Coming up, it's Ask the Attorney General. Attorney General Maura Healey is here to take our questions and yours. She is next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan here with us in Studio 3 for her monthly appearance as Attorney General Maura Healey. The Attorney General will be with us until 1 o'clock to take our questions and yours. You can email them at bpr@wgbh.org, tweet them at BOS Public Radio, or just call the Attorney General at 877-301-8970. Attorney General, good to see you.
Great to see you too, Jim, Marjorie. How
great,
are you?
Great to see you too, Attorney General Healey. I want to start with something that really upset me, and you were a prosecutor for a long time.
The fact that Isaiah Thomas did not get named the sixth man of the year.
You were unbelievable. He came in second, though.
That burns me. I know, but as he says, statistics don't lie, and That should have been his.
But. So did you think, well, since you brought it up, did you think Isaiah Thomas of our team was not the son of Isaiah Thomas, the great Detroit Pistons? You thought it was the same family, did you not?
Well, I did, right? Because I grew up during the Pistons-Lambeer-Thomas Celtics games. He's not, but that was my first thought.
Yeah, he's pretty incredible.
He's incredible, and maybe they can steal one tonight.
He's about your size, by the way. Do you know that?
That's why I got to love him.
Yeah. Well, speaking of basketball, I always love that thing on Jim's show when he used to be on NECN when he threw the basketball and you twirled it in your finger for like ever. That was unbelievable.
I still haven't forgiven him for that.
No, yeah, so
is that like riding a bicycle? Like once you learn how to twirl the basketball on your finger, you can twirl it forever?
Pretty much.
Okay.
Pretty much.
I remember also for those, this is when Maura Healey was running. I think you were in the primary against Warren Tolman at that point. She didn't know. I threw the basketball because I'd seen some, I thought, phony ad where she's doing this. Well, it turns out it wasn't phony. She started spinning it. And then I remember I turned to then candidate Healey and say, how long can you do that? And I say with disdain, she says, how long do you want me to do it?
Those were the days.
In any case.
Okay. Well, so from going something entertaining and funny to terribly depressing, I wanted to ask you about this because you were a prosecutor and you are now the attorney general. This whole story, and Jim can read the stats, but that we learned this weekend about, well, I guess it was last week actually, that the FBI essentially was cooking the books on a lot of its forensic evidence involving hair samples. And they also, in the New York Times editorial this morning, talked about, you know, ballistics were not as accurate as had been thought and testimony about bite marks. And it just really upset me because we're all across the country we're hearing these terrible situations of police officers. And it's, they're the minority, we know that, but shooting people, black young men mostly. And you hear this about the FBI, and we've had a kind of a sullied history of the FBI in Boston, most flagrantly in the Whitey Bulger trial, where the FBI was in cahoots with Whitey Bulger, or certain members of the FBI were in cahoots. So, what are we to make of the reliability of the FBI, and are they involved in state cases or not?
Well, you know, I read that, and I think there's more to read and more to learn about it, at least more that I want to learn about that particular issue. It goes to people's fundamental respect or belief in the process and the integrity of that process, and you better believe it. The federal government has an obligation to get that right. So whatever the issues were or are, they need to be addressed and addressed swiftly. You know, I'm heartened here on the state level. We do have a working relationship with the FBI, though we primarily make use of in our office state police investigators and also local police. And you know, I'm particularly mindful of the efforts most recently of the Boston Police Department. If you look at how they handled that situation a couple of weeks ago, I think they and District Attorney Conley are to be commended in terms of coming forward with
John Moynihan shot the face
in releasing that video, because you know I think we've seen other instances where things weren't handled as well, and they can sometimes tend to escalate. And I think that Boston could be and should be an example for a way to proceed. But, you know, important conversations, important dialogue on these issues right now. And I'm certainly committed to working with others in law enforcement and members of the community to make sure we're doing everything we can to get this right.
But one thing I wanted, because it seems to me, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, that if someone, say, is murdered in Boston or they're murdered in Framingham or whatever, it's often the state police that does a lot of the forensic work, correct?
Well, you have local and state investigators.
And state. Not the FBI. Generally.
Not the FBI, no.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
Well, what are you saying? But I have a question. Here's where I'm confused. In this, I'll read from this New York Times op-ed. To its credit, the Justice Department reached an agreement with the Innocence Project to review FBI testimony about hair analysis in more than 2,500 cases in more than 40 states from 85 to 99. And then it goes on to say, of the 268 cases it's looked at so far, the testimony was fundamentally flawed. This is unbelievable. In 96%. So 40 states, according to this Justice Department analysis, have these cases happened in 40 states. Are we not one of the 40 states, to your knowledge? This is before you, obviously.
Yeah, it's before me. So, Jim, I'd have to look into that. Okay. I'm assuming that these were federal prosecutions that proceeded in the various 40 states out there.
I see.
Certainly something I'll look to learn more about.
Like Sarnaev is a federal prosecution, obviously.
That's right. That's right.
Okay, our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. The voice you hear is of the Attorney General, Maura Healey, who's going to be taking your calls and questions. We've got some emails as well that came in over the transom.
Actually, this is a good one to start with. Diane asked, my question is about the constant phone calls in violation of the Do Not Call registry. We all get calls from Rachel at Cardholder Services, numerous other commercial businesses. Even if we have registered our phone numbers, would Ms. Healey be willing to take these companies on? There is a phone number. You call a phone number. You can be on a do not call. I'm in the same boat, and I continue to get calls. What's the deal with that, and what does one do if they're the subject of one of those calls?
Well, look, it is so frustrating. I get the same kind of calls at my house and now on my cell phone. I encourage everybody, get yourself signed up for the do not call registry. That's the first thing. Certainly, whenever somebody is reaching you, if you answer, ask them, of course, not to call again. I often say, where are you calling from? And let them know that I'm going to make a report to the Attorney General's office if they don't.
Hopefully that'll work out. And by the way, I'm the Attorney General.
No, I don't say that. But,
I've said that, by the way.
You said that?
All
right.
Yes.
Good. All right. Well, I'll tell you, usually that's met with a hang-up. But I continue to hear more on this issue, Jim. And so I want to take a look to see what, if anything else, we can be doing. A little bit of this is whack-a-mole in the sense that it's hard to stay on top of. But we certainly should be doing everything we can to reduce and eliminate unwelcome or unwanted calls.
What number of yours, Maura Healey, do people call if they have that kind of complaint? Is it a consumer hotline number? We'll
sure.
get it in a second.
They can call our consumer hotline, and they should call our consumer hotline. And as with anything, if we identify specific businesses or industries out there or names that people are using on whose behalf they're calling on behalf of, you know, we'll make an effort to investigate and certainly go after them if we're able to.
We'll give you the consumer hotline in about 1 minute. One last question before we get to the polls. You oppose what is likely a question going to the ballot in 2016, the legalization for recreational purposes of marijuana. Why, Attorney General?
Well, I come at this for a few reasons, but probably the biggest reason for me driving my position on this is I have real concerns about the effect it's going to have on young people. As you know, Jim, I'm somebody who supported decriminalization of marijuana in small amounts. I also support medical marijuana, and we need to right now get this right and get this implemented because there are people out there who need access to that. But when it comes to full legalization, I've not been in the camp of supporting full legalization because I think the jury's really still out in terms of the effect it could have and can have on young people. And that's why I come down on the side that I come down on.
But you know, what law enforcement, you know this, almost everybody right down the line in law enforcement was opposed to even medical marijuana. I remember talking to the Attorney General Martha Coakley when she was here about that.
All the DAs, too.
And the DAs, and also they were not in favor, I don't know if it was every one of them, but most people in law enforcement were not in favor of lessening the crime either. And I think, I mean, you must have smoked pot once or twice in your life, haven't you?
Oh, yeah. No,
okay.
I have.
And here you are, the Attorney General.
Right. And I'm also somebody who supported decriminalization and supported the medical marijuana bill. So I think I've shown a willingness to be flexible on this issue. I just think that right now I have real concerns about what this is doing to young people, what the lasting effects of this is going to be. It's one thing for adults, but I have real concerns about, you know, how this plays out for young people. And it's
even
why
though they'd
I
be treated just like liquor. If you're under 21, under any proposed law, you wouldn't be able to buy it. But
I don't think alcohol helps young people either.
Okay.
So.
But here's the thing about the young people argument that always gets me going is that you talk to any teenager, they will tell you how easy it is to get marijuana right now. And it's in some ways a little bit, you have to do a little more maneuvering to get the booze, unless you're going to steal it from your parents, you have to get someone to buy it for you or get a license or that kind of stuff. So I'm always amazed by that argument because if you legalized it, at least you would know what the marijuana was. There would be a little more regulation, we would presume. I mean, I'm sure there'll still be a black market, but there won't be as much of a black market. So with all these kids able to get marijuana now, why is it going to be any harder for them to get it when it's legal and it would be better regulated marijuana?
Well, I still don't think that justifies it or makes it right. I mean, there are a lot of things we could legalize. We could legalize cocaine or heroin. We could legalize dissemination of child pornography. It doesn't make it right. What I'm concerned about is the effect that access to marijuana is going to have on young people. In terms of the black market, it's also sort of interesting because – in Colorado, and this is just an experiment. Yeah. Colorado's had legalization for a little bit now. And what law enforcement in Colorado reports is, despite legalization, they've not seen a drop in black market activity to the point where other states have now sued Colorado to say, we've got a real problem because people are leaving our states, going to Colorado, and then coming back into our states and trafficking high amounts. So, you know, I think all of this bears noting. And as I say, we'll see where the debate goes. But at this point, I don't support legalization.
But just one last thing on this. Why is it right for the government to turn otherwise law-abiding citizens – and I don't think anybody thinks cocaine and marijuana are the same, or heroin and marijuana are the same in terms of their addictive qualities or in terms of what they do to the person. Because that's what the government's basically done. You know, we've had this whole generation of people that smoked pot in college and went on to become law-abiding citizens and would like to be able
to... President of the United States.
Exactly. But the
well,
government...
Well, he did more than marijuana, as we know.
Because of hysteria about, I would say, hysterical attitudes about marijuana, has made law-abiding citizens into criminals who want to, in their own home, use marijuana. That's my problem with this.
Well, I think that those individuals have an ability right now through decriminalization. We've certainly seen use and an increase in use. If you walk down the street, I mean, I don't know how it is. It's amazing to me when I leave Ashburton Place, I will be walking down the street and waves of marijuana all of a sudden right up there around the state house.
It's those
a,
are the state
really
reps,
it's state reps.
Reps.
I gotta work.
I knew I was gonna get in trouble with that comment. But look, I'd love to come back and talk to you more about it. I believe that we should have a serious look at the health and medical effects on young people, and we should really account for that in this process.
By the way, the Attorney General's office just provided that number that we promised you a minute ago. If you have a consumer complaint, 617-727-8400, or you can go online to mass.gov/AGO. Let's take some calls.
I just want to really quickly say we're getting a million emails. It was not the inventor of Segway who went off the cliff. It was the guy that was the CEO or the head of the company. Dean Kamen, the inventor, is still alive.
In New Hampshire, right.
Yes.
Exactly. Let's take some calls. Let's go to Richard. You're in Haverhill. You're on with the Attorney General of the Commonwealth. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Jim and Marjorie. Attorney General, you are sure a breath of fresh air. Recently, Partners Healthcare, they added 70 doctors to their staff, and they claim that won't raise the price of healthcare. Also, the new CEO still wants to take over the Lawrence Memorial Hospital in Medford and the Melrose Waco Hospital, Melrose. Do you have any authority to stop that, Attorney General?
Well, you know, the issue, Richard, you raise on healthcare is really an important issue. I heard from so many people that healthcare costs such a huge issue for families, for individuals, and certainly for businesses across this state. And I believe I do have a role, Richard. My role is to make sure that we're doing everything we can to help contain costs while still ensuring access to quality care. With regard to the particular partners transaction on the North Shore, I think at this point, in the aftermath of what's happened with the South Shore transaction, we need to wait and see what Partners is going to do next. And my position has been that they should first demonstrate an ability to contain costs, reduce costs, and hit the pause button, which is what their CEO has represented that they're going to do with respect to further transactions. In time, that could come before our office for review. Just recently, I took the initiative of filing legislation 2 weeks ago, Richard, that will give us, I think, the added teeth to be able to stop a proposed acquisition or merger if I think it's not in the best interests of consumers.
Speaking of bills, Richard, thanks for your call. Electric bills, we read almost every day, are going through the roof in this state. Why, number one? And number two, what are you doing about it, or what can you do about it?
This is such a huge issue, right? And people really got whacked this winter. Part of the problem is the price of the actual commodity, electricity itself, is way up. And there are certain things that we can control and certain things that we can't control. But with respect to what we can control, I'll tell you what I'm doing, is being active and aggressive. We've got a couple of actions now pending before FERC that challenge the amounts that utilities are charging with respect to to transmission line activity and how that those costs are getting passed on to consumers. I'm hopeful that we'll be successful and we'll find a way to return as much as $180 million to consumers. I supported what the Department of Public Utilities did last week when it said if you're a consumer and you change the supplier of your electricity, you go from Eversource to Grid or another supplier out there, that you're not going to get penalized with a recalculation going back in time. You know, it's not the largest amount of money, but it's still something. So that's good. And my job as ratepayer advocate is to make sure that we're taking a hard look at any and all costs that are getting passed on to consumers, individual homeowners, and also businesses, to make sure that they're not passing on unnecessary costs. So we're going to continue to be active and certainly received any number of complaints and calls about this in the last several weeks. So.
You know, in the grand scheme of things, you mentioned, what, $180 million. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that's huge. But in a smaller scheme, something that aggravates a lot of people, and I have to say I'm in that category, when you see that a guy who runs Eversource, used to be NSTAR, is merged with Northeast Utilities, if I'm correct, is making, what, $8 or $9 million in a monopoly. There's no competition. Essentially, people know what that means. Do you have any ability to, unless the board members or the compensation committee has violated some law, do you have any power to review those kinds of salaries? And if not, could he be paid $80 million to run a monopoly? What's the law on that, Margaret?
Well, I'll tell you. You know, the next time they come before the Department of Public Utilities asking for a rate hike, I'm going to make sure that we are there making sure that any excessive compensation isn't being passed on to ratepayers as part of any proposed rate hike. I mean, shareholders at the end of the day can decide how they want to spend their money and how they want to compensate an executive, I suppose. But my hunt and my charge is to make sure that excessive executive compensation isn't being passed on to consumers and that they're not footing the bill.
How do you know, though? But everything's so fungible. How do you know that – how does one determine that compensate – let's assume you deemed $8 million or not, whatever it is, $9 million now, excessive. Their contention would be, we're not passing any of that on to consumers. We're taking it out of – blank fund. How do you ever pierce that veil, Maura Healey? Can you?
Well, what we do is, you know, you get the documents, you do the accounting, you push, and you know, you investigate, and you look at things. And that's what we do in these rate cases.
How did that salary strike you? When you read that story in the Boston Globe, how did that strike you when you read that this head of a monopoly's made, whatever it was, $8, $9 million?
Maybe I'm in the wrong business.
I know. Should have gone into electricity running. You know.
No, I love the law, and I love being Attorney General. That's for sure. But it is a lot. It's an awful lot of money.
And then you have these little municipal light companies. There aren't very many of them, but they seem to do it for a lot less money. And I don't think their executives are picking.
Well, and I think, you know, what this goes to is the larger issue of, we here in Massachusetts, we need to be doing everything we can to harness a variety of energy sources. You know, yes, I believe we need more gas, and there's a healthy debate on about that. But, you know, we need to look at hydro and wind and solar, because it's expensive living here where we do in the Northeast with the cold winters and the hot summers. But it's all the more reason why we've got to be innovative and looking to diversify our energy mix so that at the end of the day, you know, the market isn't going to whack consumers in one direction or the other.
That's the voice of Attorney General Maura Healey. She's going to be here with us until 1:10, taking your questions and ours. Our number again, 877-301-8970. What's the email address, please, Jim?
It is BPR, thank you for asking, at WGBH.org.
BPR at WGBH.org. Maura Healey will be right back.
Today at WGBHnews.org, what is beauty? Often it's whatever the most affluent in society look like. So it's a success strategy. If you missed it on Innovation Hub, it's online at WGBHnews.org right now.
Wake up to Morning Edition on WGBH Radio. We're focused on the stories that really impact our communities. Set your alarm to 89.7 for WGBH's Morning Edition. We're up as early as you are.
WGBH Radio exists because of you. And the Boston Symphony Orchestra, conductor emeritus Bernard Haitink, leads the final concerts of the season with Portuguese pianist Maria João Pires in Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 23, April 30th through May 2nd. BSO.org. and Grogan & Company Fine Art and Jewelry Auctioneers, located at their new headquarters at 20 Charles Street on Boston's Beacon Hill. You can join them for their weekly appraisal day each Tuesday from 12 to 5 p.m. GroganCO.com.
He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan.
And this is Boston Public Radio.
89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1 Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Brown. She's Marjorie. And more importantly, she is Maura Healey, the Attorney General, who's kind enough to say she'll stay an extra handful of minutes. Before we get back to the calls, you've had a pretty good relationship so far in a whole host of things, from basketball to addiction issues with the new Republican governor. He has asked for the full board of the Department of the Transportation Board to step down. There's been some resistance. I know you don't have formal power, but as a bully, Paul, as the Attorney General, do you support the governor's? He says, I essentially, the buck will stop with me. I want full control of this thing. Is he right?
Well, I support anything and everything we can do to get this right. But, you know, my view fundamentally is that, and until and unless we have true investment in infrastructure and funding for that and make that a priority, you know, that's more important than just changing out board members, though I respect and support his prerogative in doing that. I just think that it's a very important public discussion we need to have about our priorities and how we're going to fund.
We need new revenue is what you're saying.
We need something to fund this week. I mean, I think we only have to think back on the last few weeks and months to know that we need to go in a different direction.
Not to mention, when you see the rust sort of encasing some of these Green Line cars coming down Beacon Street, it's really rather depressing. Our number is 877-301-8970. Let's go to Vinny in Arlington. Thank you for calling, Vinny.
Hi, Vinny. You're on with the Attorney General.
Hi. How are you doing today?
Great.
Good. So I had a question. I bought my house almost 10 years ago, and I didn't put down 20%. And I was told when I reached 78% of my loan that my PMI would be canceled. It actually says that in my mortgage, PMI mortgage disclosure statement. And yet my mortgage company is refusing to take off PMI. And everywhere I've read all over the internet, you know, there's a federal law that they have to, but good luck trying to get them to do it. If they do it, if they don't, you have to hire a lawyer. I mean, at this point, I really don't know what to do now. I've reached 78%, and it's over $200 a month on PMI.
Mm-hmm.
How do I get it taken off?
Well, what's the name of your mortgage company?
M&T Bank.
Okay. So I'll tell you what, Vinny. Maybe we can
number?
Arrange yep. off air, and today's your lucky day. I'll have somebody. No, seriously, Jim, because we do this kind of work regularly in the office. We spend a lot of time working with people who've had difficulty with their mortgages, with their refinancing, with servicing issues like the one that Vinny is talking about. And there are certainly any number of instances where a company is not doing right by somebody like Vinny, and we'll reach out to them and we'll make it right. So, Vinny, we'll. We'll do that, okay?
Don't go away. One of our colleagues will take your phone number, and as you heard, the Attorney General's office will be in touch. So hang tight. Stay on hold, Vinny, for a couple of seconds.
DB in Brighton, thank you for calling.
Hi, DB.
Hi, everybody.
Hi.
I have a question about how the Attorney General's office plays in protecting our environment. And what I mean by that is not making sure, you know, to stop polluters, things like that, but, you know, protecting the green space that we now have. I read somewhere Boston at one time had more than 100 ponds. Now we have 2. And so I don't know if there's any law about that, but I'd love to hear your thoughts about that.
Yeah, well, look, protecting the environment is really core work in the Attorney General's office, DB. In fact, I have an environmental protection division that exists specifically because of a statute that gives us the power and the authority to take steps to enforce laws to protect the environment. And so there are any number of them out there that speak to conservation issues, endangered species, certain steps that people need to go through in order to develop properties. So there's an awful lot there. I'd be happy to connect you with our new Energy and Environmental Bureau Chief to speak more about specific issues. I care so much about it, DB, that I actually created for the first time in the office an Energy and Environment Bureau. And we'll continue to do things like we did last week down in Washington, which was testify before Congress in support of EPA's ability to regulate. And we'll continue to work on the local level in combating and taking steps against people who dump bad things in rivers and pollute our local environment as well.
DB, thanks for the call. Speaking of environmental regulations, as you know, sort of they're strange bedfellows. Larry Tribe from Harvard is representing some coal companies, suggesting that the President of the United States has exceeded his executive authority with some of these regulatory actions, which have caused places like the New York Times to say he's the best president for the environment ever. But it's premised on the same thing that Larry Tribe says he doesn't have the power to do. Who's right?
President's right.
Do you really believe he's right?
Or absolutely. You just believe he's... I think Larry Tribe is wrong there. I think the arguments that he's advancing are wrong. And we as a state have come in on the other side of that issue to say that the Environmental Protection Agency has the power and the authority to regulate in this space.
Oh, so it's, you're part of this?
We are part of it. Along with other states. And, you know, I think this is an important issue. And let's remember, it was Massachusetts that many years ago, under another attorney general, brought the case, the real seminal case before the Supreme Court, Mass versus EPA, that basically said for the first time in the wake of George Bush's refusal to take action and regulate in this area, that they actually had to. And the Supreme Court ordered that. Really significant. We have a long and proud tradition and history here in Massachusetts of standing up on environmental matters, and I'll certainly continue to do that as Attorney General. So we'll see what happens.
Thanks for the call, DB.
Far be it from me to call Larry Tribe wrong, but I am. But I am in this instance.
Okay, let's go to Jonathan in Worcester. Hi, Jonathan.
Hello, Jonathan.
How are you? Thank you so much for taking the call.
Thanks for calling.
I was just wondering, I'm sure you know about the recent spat of police brutality here in Worcester where a African-American male was accosted in the cell. The department says that's their policy not to release the tapes. I was just wondering if there was any plan for maybe on a state level to get those released.
By the way, I don't know about the attacks in Worcester. Do you know about these?
Jonathan, I think you're speaking of the incident. There was an arraignment a couple weeks ago. Back in December, I believe the allegation is that a Worcester police officer taking a suspect into custody into an actual cell is alleged to have assaulted physically and verbally this detainee who was African-American. He has been charged by the Worcester County District Attorney's Office and is being prosecuted, the police officer. But certainly as somebody who's been both a civil rights attorney and a prosecutor, I take these allegations and these issues very seriously. And, you know, as I said earlier, I'll certainly be looking to make sure that that as we review this, we're taking the right steps to ensure that people's civil rights are protected.
Thank you much for the call. You know, speaking of civil rights, you were kind enough to join me on Greater Boston about 2 weeks ago, and I asked you about a position you had taken in a debate that I moderated with you and Warren Tolman when you were running for the Democratic nomination. You both took issue with your predecessors and your former bosses' position that she didn't have the jurisdiction to take a look at the shooting of Ibrahim Todashev, the man who, according to the FBI, along with Tamerlan Tsarnaev, were responsible for the triple murder in Waltham that preceded the marathon bombing by 18 months. You both said that you would have done otherwise. I asked you about it, and you said, transparency is always important, so my answer remains yes at this point. I need to get an update on where things are on that particular matter before I make any decisions. Do you know more than we knew when you knew when we saw each other 2 weeks ago?
You know, after you raised this, Jim, I went back and looked, and here's what I know. That matter was investigated by the Florida state authorities, was also investigated by the United States Department of Justice Civil Rights Division. Both investigations exonerated the police officers involved, and those reports are public. We also have going on here in Middlesex County the prosecution of that triple homicide, and that is currently underway. I am mindful of
what does it mean underway? I mean, Tamerlan Tsarnaev is dead.
Ibrahim Todashev is dead. So how is the...
Well, I understand that that matter is still before the Middlesex County District Attorney's Office. And so I wouldn't want anything at this particular juncture to compromise the investigation and prosecution handling of that matter. But I am going to continue to review it, as I said, and come back to you. And tell you what I'm going to do.
And by the way, we should say for people who are saying, why are we even asking this question? There were two Massachusetts state troopers in and around the apartment at the time of the shooting. Can I just get back to this? I was totally unaware of this. The Middlesex County DA still has an active case involving the Waltham triple murders from whatever that was, September 11th of 2011, I guess it was. There's an active case.
Yeah, that's my understanding.
And so does that mean theoretically that they believe, well, as a former prosecutor, well, you're the lead prosecutor in Massachusetts, if the two men who are responsible for it are dead, should we then assume that they believe that there may be other people who are involved in this? Do you ordinarily continue an investigation if the alleged perpetrators have been killed?
Well, I don't want to speak to the specifics of this particular matter, but... Suffice it to say that I'm reviewing it.
And, okay. Thank you.
You know, here's a good question for the Attorney General. I don't know if this is in your purview, but you hear about this all the time. Robert from Watertown wants
It doesn't to... matter, really, whether it's in my purview or not. I've come to learn.
Yeah, okay.
It's all in her purview.
This is a good question for all of us who are upset about these unpaid summer internships, especially for college kids. Mm-hmm. He wants to know why it's legal for companies to hire interns and put them to work and not pay them.
Yeah, well, as a general matter, they have to be paid. There are certain exemptions and exemptions for that. But, you know, I think it's important right now, particularly as we face summer and as somebody who worked, you know, every summer through high school and college, it's important for people to go onto our website, look at their rights as employees for the summer so that they're treated fairly. One thing that I'm focused on right now that relates to the issue of workers is we have got this new earned sick time law coming out. And for those who don't know, your listeners, last year the voters passed through a ballot initiative a law that provides now access to earned sick time for workers across the state. And it's estimated that approximately 1 million more people are going to qualify for earned sick time. A lot of us already have that through our employers.
Oops.
We have a little bit of a sound problem here. I think we're off. I believe we're off the air and something else is playing. It's playing in our ears at least. Okay, now we're fine. We're fine.
Now
sorry,
we're fine.
Attorney
sorry.
General. Yeah.
Sorry.
Say that again, please. 1 million people.
Earned sick time. Important law that the voters passed last year through the ballot. Up to 1 million people are now going to qualify in Massachusetts. Many of us already have this, so it's not going to change anything for us or for employers. But it will require us in the Attorney General's office, since we are going to have to enforce it, to implement some regulations. And so we've been working very hard in the last few weeks to get input from businesses and employers and workers' rights groups as well to craft workable, sensible regulations that will go effective with the law come July 1st.
You know, speaking of regulations, before you go, we only have 60 seconds left. The governor was here the other day, and we asked him about the continuing failure to open any of the medicinal marijuana dispensaries. He actually had his staff person check and said, I hope I got this right, that the first one is scheduled to open this summer. Are you under the impression that we're finally about to actually have some of these things that the people voted for, two and a half years ago? Is it imminent as far as you know, Attorney General?
I don't know that I'd say it's imminent. I know that there is a heightened urgency and that the governor has made clear that he is working to get this done. And certainly my office will work with the administration on implementation so that we can finally get this in place and up and running.
You two are really getting along, aren't you?
The governor and I?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Have there been any major policy disagreements so far?
They both played basketball.
We know that.
It's Harvard.
Right. No, you know, I mean, look, I think that both of us and our teams are just working hard. We've got a lot of issues confronting us here in the state, and I think it's really important that all of us in government come together and try to craft workable solutions for people. So that's what we're Great. About day in and day out.
Now, by the way, if you're on hold, if you stay on hold, we will take your number and give it to the Attorney General's office, and they will be in touch. If you send an email, it will be forwarded.
Yeah, especially poor Robert. He's got a $500 a month electric bill. He's ready to be pulling his
hair
out.
It to the Attorney General.
We will take care of Robert.
Maura Healey, thank you so much. We really appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me on.
Attorney General Maura Healey joins us every month for Ask the AG. Thank you also, Attorney General, for coming in. Coming up, WGBH arts editor Jared Bowen joins us to talk about the local art scene, from sloshed Shakespeare to sober performances from James Franco and Jonah Hill. That's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. GBH arts editor Jared Bowen is here to talk about a wide range of local arts happenings, from Shakespeare hitting the sauce to the saucy stage play Thoroughly Muslim Millie. Jared Bowen also hosts the TV show Open Studio and is one of the three coaches on the brand new and wonderful Sing That Thing. Hey, Jared, congratulations on the premiere.
Wasn't it a fun show?
Oh, my goodness. Some of those groups were so talented. Those kids from Dorchester were great.
Forget the kids. How about the older women in the Merrimack Valley Chorus? Are you kidding me?
Well, and those dresses they had on, they looked like
What was your line?
That it was. It looked like it was, Richard Simmons and Phyllis Diller had a
baby. Right?
Yeah, no, it's a great fun show, but also fun because I saw it on Greater Boston, Jim's new show.
Yeah.
You guys went and saw a play together with Jim crabbing the entire time. So please tell us about this fascinating concept of cocktailing during performing.
Well, Jim and I went to see A Midsummer Night's Dream.
We did.
However, it's presented by, we cannot say the name of the theater company that presents it. It's Blank-Faced Shakespeare. You know, if you get drunk, you'll get also, you get blank, you don't
exactly
understand where I'm going with this. And so the conceit here is that they have this group of classically trained actors, five actors, and these are really extraordinary actors. In the moments where they were actually acting and doing Shakespeare, Midsummer Night's Dream, I thought they were quite fantastic. And they've been doing this in England around all the fringe festivals. But what separates them is they get one cast member completely drunk right before – Marjorie, I know. I see your smile. You love this. It's quite fun. They get them completely drunk right before the performance. And in this case, it was an actress who had allegedly 3/4 of a bottle of Smirnoff and 2 Chinese beers before coming out.
By the way, everybody's asked you since, was she really drunk? The answer is she was really drunk. Is that not clear?
I had a question at first, but then because we had our producer backstage, and she told me that she saw her drinking backstage, and she had conversations with her. But because she could also have been a really great actress. It's hilarious, though, right, when she comes out. And I know people are already probably listening, thinking, why is this appropriate?
Don O'Coyne in The Globe basically saying, not in these words, if you laughed at this, you support drunk driving. I mean, it was...
Wait a minute. She wasn't driving. She was on the stage.
No, I know, but
correct?
Well, I'm exaggerating. He basically said in the Boston Globe, you know, with the problem of binge drinking, why is it so funny to see a woman like stumbling around the stage? It was funny. I mean, she wasn't driving. She wasn't out in the world. It was for that. I thought it was a riot.
Does she get her lines right, or does she mess them all up?
She does. She get a lot of lines right, actually, and she sped through a lot of her lines. So this is clearly somebody who's not obliterated. But part of the fun of this show is that it's improv. It ends up being improv at the end of the day, because you're dealing with this colleague who has suddenly gone off the rails and is taking the show into her own hands, taking the audience literally into her own hands at certain points. So I thought it was quite fun. You know, and it does, maybe this is a stretch. I'm sure I'll be criticized for this, but I think it does harken back a little bit to the days of Shakespeare in The Globe, when you had these raucous audiences and they were throwing vegetables on the stage and they were yelling and shouting, and it was a huge event to go see a play. Of course, it wasn't held in the high esteem that we hold Shakespeare today. They were just modern pieces, but this is how people behaved to some degree and interacted.
This is Davis Square Theater. Is that what it's called?
Davis Square Theater.
In Davis Square, it's one act. Jared only thinks I can sit through one act.
He was like 5 minutes late getting there. Jared was, and Jim was hysterical, complaining about how it was. He had to wait an extra 5 minutes.
But with all
minutes.
Due respect to the critic, it is really, really funny. And as you say, it's improv, Shakespeare improv, and it's terrific.
Well, let's move on to Ryan Landry. We've had him in here in the studio several times, and his stuff is just hysterical. Now he's got a new play. I love this called Thoroughly Muslim Millie. Please tell us about it.
This, I have to say, is probably one of Ryan Landry and the Gold Dust Orphans' best productions ever. And it comes at a time when we at the Boston Theater Critics Association have just named him. He will receive the Elliot Norton Prize this year, next month, May 11th, at our big awards ceremony, basically the Boston version of the Tonys. This is the prize for sustained excellence. This is a theater troupe that has been creating great, adventurous, new theater in Boston for 20 years, but it's still the same. He hasn't catapulted up to these big professional ranks in a big proscenium theater. You still go to the Machine nightclub, go downstairs and see these productions. Ryan Landry always does these spoofs. This one is really, really poignant, and it's very funny. It's satire. He's got great songs, great dance. He's got really terrific cast members and singing now.
Anything Muslims do, Catholics do better. Exactly. I haven't seen it, but I read. I mean, how funny.
Well, this is what I love, because just take a look at that one song. Anything Catholics can do, Muslims can do better. You can see the point of view that Ryan Landy has with this show, which I think could be subtitled In Defense of Muslims. So the plot here is that you have, well, actually, he kills off poor Julie Andrews in the first 5 seconds.
Oh, no.
She's twirling around the hilltop in the Swiss Alps, and suddenly she succumbs to a drone attack. And so you have Millie, who's sent from a Canadian convent over to marry the Prince of Persia, and it turns out that the convent is run by Lynn and Dick Cheney, who are eager to get at the oil beneath the Prince of Persia's home. But you see these notions of imperialism and the Western perceptions of the Middle East and Muslim culture. So Ryan Landry takes on a lot very smartly here.
By the way, some of his other great works, I went last year, and it is just brilliant. Phantom of the Opera, Pornocchio, Mildred Fierce. I mean, they are real. They're really raunchy, I should say. They are really funny. It's a great place. I mean, what's the name of the joint again where he does this?
It's a Machine nightclub.
Right. It is an odd sort of setting, by the way. And speaking of drinking, virtually all the audience is drinking during the thing. It's a great night. If you're ready for this pushing the envelope kind of thing.
It's so clever and so original and so different.
It really is. Yeah. It's very, very smart.
Okay, so going from something that's really funny and entertaining to something you probably want to slit your wrist at the end of watching, please tell us about the Huntington Theater Company's comeback, Little Sheba.
Well, actually, I will say that just like Thoroughly Muslim Millie, this is one of the best shows I've seen in quite some time, and an absolute must-see in Boston right now. And Come Back, Little Sheba is William Ng's play from the 50s, yeah. And he sets us down in this home, in this living room of Doc and Lola, and they're a couple that are late 30s, and this play is essentially all about looking, because they're childless. He's been wrestling with alcohol addiction. She has this desperate loneliness. She tries consistently to reach out to the mailman, to the postman, to the milkman, anybody who comes her way. And they've taken on a young boarder, this young, vibrant woman. And she becomes this trigger for everything that's not right in their lives, their relationship that isn't right. Lola doesn't think she's pretty anymore because she looks at this beautiful young woman and sees who she used to be. They see the failings of their relationship and what never materialized. But this is directed so beautifully by David Cromer, who did Our Town for the Huntington Theater Company a couple years ago, in this small space that you feel like you're almost sitting in their living room. So it's very, very almost claustrophobic. It's
what
incredibly
small mean?
Intimate.
How small, small?
It's just a few hundred seats.
Uh-huh, okay.
So you're all sitting, you feel everything's happening right before you. And Adrian Krasansky, who plays Lola, is just so riveting. You cannot help but feel for her, everything that comes out of her mouth about this loneliness that she has, this desperation that she feels for her husband. And it's actually quite funny, too, because she's a woman who has a great deal of conviction. She can be very, very strong until her situation begins to fall apart. I personally appreciate these great pieces from the 1950s. Unfortunately, Ng is somebody who didn't survive as well as Tennessee Williams and Arthur Miller, these other great playwrights of that era. And I don't know why, because his work really holds up, especially in the hands of a great director like it has now.
So is there, you said it really holds up. Is there anything, when you're watching this, is there anything you say, this is not now, this could not be now, or is it all, is sort of that timeless thing?
Well, I think they've taken those elements out. You certainly feel that you're in the 1950s, but the themes are just as resonant. I mean, we all have these insecurities about our lives, our relationship, looking back, and all of that just powerfully explodes to the fore. And I should say that this actually has done so well already, they have extended the run by another week or two.
You know, I have to say, also, these small settings
are
really great. I mean, from blank face Shakespeare, which, what is that, 75 or 100?
Yeah.
It really changes the whole, I mean, I don't have your expertise. It really changes the whole experience.
Yeah. If you go
for
to
a casual theater goer, it really does.
And you're in the second balcony and you feel like you're about 550 feet from the stage and you need binoculars. It's not quite the same.
No,
well, it's like
not.
When we went to the, when you and I went with Brian McCreath and Ron Della Chiesa to see Andras Nelson's for the first time. I mean, apparently it's, as Nelson's told us, the best acoustics anywhere in the world, practically. But when you're sitting in a balcony right on top of Nelson's,
it's
a whole different kind of thing. In any case, let's go to the MFA, which has a new director. We know, since you helped break that story last week, Japan comes in a number of incarnations to the MFA. Let's start with this photograph exhibit of sort of the post March 11th, 2011. That's the earthquake and obviously the tsunami afterwards. This sounds incredibly powerful.
It is, and this is the first time that this has been done. So obviously, March 11th, 2001, as you mentioned, there was the earthquake
11.
That led...
2011.
2011,
yeah.
Sorry. Yeah. That led to this horrific tsunami that led to the nuclear meltdown. So this triple disaster that happened in Japan, and this show, In the Wake, Japanese photographers respond to 311, looks at how Japanese photographers interpreted what happened to their homeland. Japan is still reeling from this. They have not been able to show an exhibition like this, but the MFA, with its relationship, its museum in Japan, has a relationship with that nation. They've always had a very strong Asian art holding, and so they very smartly put together this show, the first in the world. And you have a couple of different perspectives. You have photographers who returned home, because a lot of these photographers are very well known. They travel around the world, so many of them weren't home. They weren't in Japan when this happened. So you see what they had to seek out when they arrived home, and just utter devastation, but how they interpreted it in photography. And then this whole notion of the nuclear meltdown and what photographers, how they captured that, mindful that this is certainly not the first time there's been a nuclear disaster in Japan. I'm of course, referring to Hiroshima. And so you see photographers working in that realm, too. One of the most searing elements to me was this photographer who had taken all of these pictures of ordinary life and then went back after the nuclear fallout and literally slashed his negatives with a scissor. So you see it looks like black rain falling on everyday streets and people just walking, happily walking down the street. It's a reminder that everything has changed. You have these photographs of dead animals. You have photographers who were able to go in for a very limited time, of course, to the area around the nuclear power plant, which is now quite beautiful because it's lush and green. Man hasn't touched it in a couple of years. So you have all these really dynamic, very different perspectives, and it's very chilling. Also, one of the most important things I think they do in this exhibition is they have this video of the tsunami, the wave washing forward, and it brings to bear the weight of this, because you think it's a wave washing forward. Well, of course, that's not it. It's cars, it's boats, it's homes, and all of this debris, you know, cities being collected in the water and moving over the land so quickly. And you see these cars driving up the road knowing that they probably didn't make it because the water was traveling so fast.
How did the MFA, you said it's the first such exhibit anywhere. How does the MFA, how does any museum get this? And obviously the prize is to be first, not only to do it well, but to do it before. How do they get ahead of everybody else? Because of their reputation, because of the aggressiveness of Rogers? What is it?
Well, I think it's all of it, but most importantly, because they have this relationship in Japan with their museum outpost there.
I see.
So they are very much on top of what's happening, and they knew that this is something to look at.
Wow. And just the pictures that we saw that were reprinted in the Globe, I mean, are just haunting.
Speaking, to go from tsunamis to just traditional waves, you know, I'm almost embarrassed.
Traditional
I'm almost
waves.
Embarrassed to say this, but for those of us who are not great
consumers of great art, you say to yourself, there are about five paintings you got to see before you die. And I've seen two or three of them around the world. But the Great Wave, as it's called, Under the Wave of Kanagawa, obviously is at the MFA now with this master, Hokusai. Have you been there, by the way, yet?
I have seen it, yeah.
And what is it like being when I'm in the presence of something that is so huge, I can't even describe it. What's it like to see that one painting, and then you can describe the whole exhibit?
Oh, it's absolutely mesmerizing. I think that's what's great about art, is that you can have a whole community, and in this case, centuries of communities, that draw your eye to this one piece that, for whatever reason, has really captivated people. Well, the reason is it's just so gorgeous and it's iconic, and the print work is just extraordinary. The color is extraordinary, and that's part of the reason it became so famous. Is he used a blue that had never been used before? I think it's a Prussian blue or something.
Was that so?
Yeah, and so this is why it really stood out, and it stands out still because it's just there's just something that emotionally resonates.
How big is it?
It's not very big at all, actually. I don't know the dimensions, but it's pretty ordinary. And so this is what Hokusai did, is Hokusai created, when he was working, he lived from 1760 to 1849, and he created prints that were to be disseminated for basically the cost of noodles in a lot of cases.
Yeah.
We just go here, there, and everywhere, get them out into the world, have people appreciate them, and maybe they're saved, maybe they're discarded. But he worked in all of these different realms. This is not an area where I have a whole bunch of expertise in, but I walked into this exhibition and was completely bowled over. I was bowled over by the color, by the images, by the simplicity of his lines in drawing figures and scenes. And he was somebody who was so prolific. He worked so much throughout his career, always endeavoring to do something new, whether it was creating Japanese mythology or moving into landscapes, also something that had never been done in Japan. And that's where the wave came from, or working in nature and birds and flowers. Even at the end of his life, near his deathbed, he said, I just want to create more. He wanted another 10 years. He's somebody who you often see people at the end of their lives, Turner, many people like that, who they just go off in a far-flung direction. It doesn't mean they're any less good, but they're so different. But he remained consistently good about how he was working in prints and creating in color and just always pushing the new. I just loved this show.
And he obviously was, his skills were still intact well into his later life. I mean, the Great Wave was amongst things he did, I read, when he was 70 years old.
Yep. Yes.
Yeah, he did not, they have actually one of the last pieces, and it's, as I mentioned, the Wave, like many of the other pieces, is pretty ordinary in size, nothing extremely large, but they do have one of his last major prints, and it's quite magnificent. It's very thin, very tall, so it was a masterpiece for him.
So both of these things are going on right now at the MFA.
Yeah, it's very, very smart programming for the MFA to do this.
Okay, let's go to the movie theaters. Now, we're going to play a clip, and I know you love this movie, but The Coast, we'll bullet this there. It's called The Clouds of Sils Marie. It stars the great Juliette Binoche and Kristen Stewart. Let's listen.
The play tells a simple story. An older woman falls in love with a scheming girl that has her wrapped around her little finger. The girl takes advantage of her, squeezes everything she can out of her, then dumps her.
It's called The Real World. Welcome.
Time. Youth. She has her life ahead of her.
I'm in the middle of a divorce. I feel alone and vulnerable.
What's wrong with my acting?
Nothing.
Okay, I'll try to keep an open mind. I know. Why do you love it? And Kristen Stewart? I mean,
she's supposedly pretty good. The review said she wasn't
bad. You ever see any of the Twilight?
Twilight. I know. I mean, well, you can't. You can't.
Why
forever.
Can't you?
Well, Clint Eastwood used to be in spaghetti westerns. He kind of turned his career around.
Yeah, that was like 50 years ago. Okay, your turn, Jared Bowen. You loved it, yes?
Two words: Channing Tatum. Look at Channing Tatum.
That's actually a good response.
They're very good.
Okay, go ahead.
So, and I should mention, Kristen Stewart won the French equivalent of the Oscar for the best supporting role for this film. This is a bizarre film, but it's so good. Juliette Binoche is this actress who is in her 40s, and she's a superstar, major superstar. In fact, we see her draped in Chanel, the big sunglasses, paparazzi's chasing her. And she gets this offer to return to this piece that made her famous, where she played this young ingenue who, in a lesbian relationship, sort of takes down this woman who's 20 years older than her. She's cause for her ruin. Now Julia Binoche is asked to play the older woman, to revisit this piece, but play the older woman, and she really struggles with it. So she retreats to the mountains, to the Swiss Alps, to the clouds of Sils Maria, and she's running lines with her assistant, played by Kristen Stewart. And suddenly the women in living together in these tight quarters as she's trying to figure out this role start to take on elements of the play themselves. So you see Kristen Stewart challenging her boss, provoking her, bringing about her insecurities, because Kristen Stewart is also, Juliette Binoche is also realizing that she's now a woman of a certain age, just like this character in the play, and maybe she has failings just like this character in the play. Juliette Binoche is an actor of a certain age, so it has all of these very meta elements that come to the fore, and it makes it just so engaging. If you love art, if you love film and stage and theater, and you if you love pop culture, all of it comes to the fore here. Chloe Grace Moritz plays the young actor who's going to be brought in to play against her, and you can see how she's manipulating her. So it has all these wonderful angles. I just thought it was so delicious.
Is Little Birdman-esque or no?
I was thinking about it in that regard. I think they absolutely could be considered in the same vein. Very different styles of filmmaking. But, yeah, a lot of the same themes.
And Kristen Stewart is good.
She's good.
She's good.
Okay. See, you can't always judge by the first thing they absolutely do, which was a little bit embarrassing.
That's what they say about our radio career.
Exactly. And I think a lot of men can't get the vampire thing. It's a teen girl kind of thing, I think, isn't it? Yeah, I think so. But this other one, okay, this got totally trashed. I don't know if you agree with this. This is a true story, the new movie with the James Franco and
he's horrible
Jonah
too.
Hill.
I mean, really. I mean, James Franco? You're a fan of James Franco, too?
I really liked him in this movie. He was the only good thing about this movie.
It's called True Story. Let's play the sound. James Franco is a man charged with killing his entire family. That's nice. Jonah Hill is a former New York Times reporter. Here's Franco playing Christian Longo in a prison visitation room, talking about how normal he is.
You know, there's a mathematical technique that will determine how ordinary a person you are. Not just your looks, but your whole life.
Really?
By my calculations, I'd say I'm pretty ordinary. I've been decent and regular for 92.88% of the time. But you couldn't tell that from reading the papers.
Okay, this is all about a story about reporters and killers getting too close together, and there was a lot of talk about that, famously in Cold Blood, the Truman Capote story where he got too involved with the killers, lots of people think. So this is a fictional takeoff on this, or is it fiction?
No, this is a true story.
Of this reporter that made him, that fabricated something.
Yep, yeah, okay. And so this is based on his book, Michael Finkel. He had written, he was his superstar young reporter, 10 New York Magazine covers in 3 years. But then he fudged a story that he did about slave labor and how children were treated in Africa. Fired, sent, goes off to Montana to try to figure out what he's going to do with his life, and finds out that this killer, Christian Longo, had been captured, but he'd been using Michael Finkel's identity. So he meets with Christian Longo to figure out what the story is there, and maybe this is going to be how he rehabilitates his career by telling this story. So you find both of these men together, and you don't quite know what Christian Longo did. Did he really murder his family? Is he covering for something? This is drawn out through the course of the film. It's not a very good film. It's not very engaging, although I did think that James Franco was fantastic as Christian Longo.
Wait, so that really happened? I was confused. It really happened that this reporter actually is his life is impersonated by this killer?
Yes.
That was really true?
That's really true.
Oh, my God.
And apparently, the coda to the film, they still meet. I don't know how often, but they still do see each other in prison.
Yeah, let me just defend myself for a second. I can't hear. Now, maybe you shouldn't judge Kristen Stewart by Twilight Forever.
Yeah.
James Franco, what was that thing where
he
had to cut
Academy
off his hand
Awards
to save his life?
Yeah.
What was it called, 24 Hours or something?
Climbing like accident.
One of the worst movies and the worst performances.
I think he chopped off his whole arm, didn't he?
I think he did. But he was, so he's good in this thing?
He's very good.
And Jonah Hill, was it Jonah Hill a one-and-done thing? I mean, obviously Wolf of Wall Street. You didn't like him in that?
No, I thought he was good in Moneyball.
Oh, I didn't see Moneyball. I thought he was great in you thought he was good in one thing.
True,
I thought he was good in another. Is he? It's sort of my attitude was you did it, like go back to doing what you used to do, stupid comedies. No?
No, he's going to keep doing these apparently. I'm not sure
how
why.
How was he in this?
I didn't think he was very convincing at all.
Oh.
Okay. Okay, well, we agree on that.
Yeah. All right, that takes okay. care of that. So one really good one and one
on
really terrible.
Well, we're going to go to the MFA. I mean, we're both dying to see both these shows. We're there.
Oh, and, I mean, and all these great plays you talked about. I mean, the Huntington Theater, once again, has an enormous, enormously wonderful play on its hand. Jared Bowen, thank you so much for coming in.
I was going to say, when's the next? Is it Friday night again? Is Sing That Thing Part 2? Is that what it is?
It's like the Jared Bowen Hour on GBH now.
Oh, right. Open Studio.
Sing That Thing at 8.
Yeah.
Open Studio at 8:30.
Perfect.
But, you know, the Sing That Thing, it is so fun to see all these groups of amateur singers. I mean, they have this a cappella group from BU. They have this big, I don't know if it was a gospel choir, but it's a big choir from Dorchester, high school kids, and those women you talked about. So it's really great.
Singing's great. Yeah,
yeah,
really
and to listen to these people talk about what the singing means in their lives is pretty. Makes me want to go out and join the choir. I don't know if I'll actually do that, but in any case, Jared Bowen is WGBH arts editor and host of Open Studio, which you can catch Friday nights at 8:30 right here on WGBH Channel 2, right after Sing That Thing, which you can catch at 8 o'clock right here on Channel 2 and a bunch of other places as well, correct?
It is all over the place.
Coming up, a CEO maxes out the minimum wage. Harvard historian Nancy Kane joins us for that conversation next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. So today there are two tales of the minimum wage playing out. We have fast food workers fighting to earn $15 an hour. And then tipping the other side of the pay scale, a CEO in Seattle is giving his employees a minimum wage that will average out to $70,000 a year. Dan Price is the CEO of Gravity. It's a credit card processing firm. Slashing his $1 million salary so that he can give all 70, or I think it's actually 120 of his employees, a wage that amounts to $70,000 a year. His employees, obviously, are heralding him as a champ, and some business insiders say he is a chump. Speaking of Price, here he is talking about why it makes good business sense to have a $70,000 a year minimum salary.
I actually think that this is a winning move. I think this is a competitive move. I think that this will allow us to be stronger. I can go a few years making a lot less and want to take care of folks. And, like, this is a risk that's worth taking. And so I just did it.
Yes, he did. Here with us in Studio 3 for her take on this is Nancy Kane. Nancy is an historian at the Harvard Business School. She holds the James E. Robison Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Hey, Nancy.
Hey there.
Yeah, and I don't know if you said this, Jim, but he took a pay cut himself to $70,000.
Yeah, fund, I did say it, to fund the $70,000. Yeah.
It's incredible. So, or is this ridiculous? What do you think about this Mr. Price out there in Seattle?
I think it's terrific, and I think it makes sense strategically in terms of his business and what he hopes to achieve with it. I think it's a great example of business, if you will, stepping up to a bigger plate that includes some kinds of social input or impact in the new world of leadership and business success. I think his rationale, there may be more to his rationale, but his public rationale about a friend walked me through the arithmetic of keeping things together, maintaining and supporting a family on $40,000 a year. And a light bulb went out on, and I realized how hard that is.
Yeah.
And I decided to do something about it. I think that's fascinating. I think and important and to be applauded. I think the criticism coming at him, and the New York Times, dear listeners, ran a story about this, has run a couple of stories about this. Most recently, April 19th, Patricia Cohen, C-O-H-E-N, praise and skepticism as one executive sets minimum wage to $70,000 a year. I think that a lot of the criticism coming at him, Patricia Cohen quotes economists and some policy folks at think tanks saying, well, this is really not a good idea. It's not paying attention to market economics. Doom and gloom and Armageddon is just around the corner. I think those folks didn't get the memo about the 21st century. So, you know, the memo is, We need to run sustainable enterprises. That means we want engaged, loyal, serious, problem-solving, customer-responsive employees. And the best way to do that is to, you know, give them a job, create engagement, and pay them a living wage. And so I think it's really just another example of the inflection point at which leadership And companies, public and private, this is a private company, dear listeners, that's important. Important inflection point at which companies and leaders in the business world find themselves.
Yeah, I'm not sure any of this is going to be replicated. The point to me of the story, the memo, is that a statement is being made to highlight the grotesque inequity. What's the rough number now? The average CEO makes 350 times as much as his or her average worker, 350 times as much. So I don't think that Tim Cook is about to cut his salary to $70,000 so that I did the math.
From
so that his
98,000
rate. His 98,000 employees can get an extra $1,000 a year, which is not insignificant. But it's a high-profile example that virtually everybody's talking about a guy who understands that inequity is bad for business, not just bad for the people
who are
being treated poorly, no?
Exactly. I think that's exactly right. And he makes, you know, a very explicit statement, a very explicit case for this is about income inequality. And I wanted to do something about it. He's 29 years old, you should know, dear listeners. He's been in this business for almost a decade, and it sounds like he's from an entrepreneurial family. One other important fact is, just return to something I alluded to earlier, it's private. So he doesn't have the same kind of pressures acting on him. He has a little bit more latitude, maybe some would say a lot more latitude, to do what he will with his company, because I believe he and his brother are the only shareholders in it.
And when you talk about the pressures, explain that.
Well, you can imagine, and the end of the Patricia Cohen story quotes a business observer talking about, I'm on the board of a number of public companies, and this would not be easy to do in a public company because Dan Price, the CEO of Gravity Payments, the company we're talking about, is going to take not only some of his income, right, but he's going to do this, to fund this. It's going to be phased in over the next couple of years, a salary raise. But he's also going to ineffectively eat into some of the profits of the company. There would be a lot of opposition to eating into what we call the bottom line. That's the net income line, dear listeners, to a company's income statement, if that was going to affect the stock price, you know, be taken away, money that was otherwise used as dividends,
right,
et cetera. So this would be harder, no question, it would be harder to do in a public company. That being said, we're seeing public company CEOs make very interesting investments with company profits. I'm thinking of Howard Schultz, the CEO of Starbucks, or Paul Polman at Unilever, who are also putting a big foot onto the social stage with company resources.
You know, so what was the first CEO name that came to mind for either of you when you read the Dan Price story? And I'll give you my answer in a second.
Oh, I know what you're going to say.
Who?
The guy up Malden Mills.
Exactly.
Guy.
If you don't remember the story,
this is a
factory at Malden Mills in Lawrence, Massachusetts, burned down in 1995. And the CEO, his name was Aaron Feuerstein, kept all of his employees on salary with full health benefits at a cost to him of $25 million while the place was rebuilt. I remember him being at a State of the Union speech and was acknowledged by, I guess it was then, Bill Clinton. Here he is in a 60 Minutes interview explaining his decision.
I think it was a wise business decision, but that isn't why I did it. I did it because it was the right thing to do.
Some might have said the proper business decision for a 70-year-old guy is to take the $300 million in insurance and retire.
And what would I do with it? Eat more? Buy another suit? Retire and die? No, that did not go into my mind. That was not an option, not for a second.
That is Aaron Feuerstein talking about why he funded $25 million in salary and health benefits for his employees while none of them could work because his place had burnt down. It's just what an amazing story.
You know, Nancy Kane, you wrote a great piece in the Washington Post with a theory about why men get this, and some women, but mostly men get these huge.
Why this is so out of control?
Yes, but before we get to the whole great man, great pay theory, you mentioned in this piece that Thomas Piketty, we've talked about him before, the French economist who wrote the new book Capital in the 21st Century. It's not so new now, but it's fairly new. That sometime in the 1970s, society became more tolerant of once unacceptably high levels of executive pay, and because we're related to this kind of superstardom thing. But I think that's so important for us to remember that, you know, people, they're. I would be embarrassed I mean, $100 million? Mm. I can't even imagine. But you'd feel embarrassed. You'd feel like, that's too much money. But these people aren't, like, shamed as gluttons and stealing all this. They're not stealing all the money. No one thinks Steve Jobs was horrible when he's making all that money at Apple or this Cook guy or the other of the executives that are making these astronomical sums of money. So I guess why do we not think of them as gluttons?
Well, I think it's a couple of reasons. First, I'm on the board of a public company. I'm not on the compensation committee of that board. This is Tempur-Pedic Mattress, but we engage in discussions every year about CEO salary, and so it's a very interesting process. And we're below our CEO is paid no more than the average of peer companies in their representative group. But it's very interesting, and this is a very, very different game than $78 million for Larry Ellison, $100 million for Tim Cook at Apple, and some of the other folks that have received the highest salaries of public company executives last year. One very interesting aspect, or one answer to your question, it's one of several, is that we are comparing CEO salaries with other CEO salaries. So it's a little bubble up in the ether where compensation consultants and board members, many of whom are CEOs, are operating in this very, very isolated world that says, well, this is how much this CEO made, this is how much this CEO made, and it's been allowed, not without consciousness. It's not like people are asleep at the wheel, to get way, way, way out of hand. And the reason I say way out of hand is not just the raw numbers. It's because of this issue of income inequality. So one other important factor, listeners, that Piketty is at great pains to demonstrate based on very, very, very good, serious time study and other quantitative research, is that if you look at the top 10th of 1% of the income distribution in America today. He's done this with tax returns over the last 20 years. 60 to 70% of those people are corporate executives. So it's not the income distribution skewing isn't about Madonna. It's not about sports stars. It's about very, very highly paid, mostly men in the C-suite. So we got a major public policy and social issue here. So one reason is we're all in a circular little world. A second reason is this idea, I think, that at some level, we got lost collectively and think that the leader of a public corporation is somehow larger than life and cut from the rib of Zeus and going to deliver us into the promised land and the new Jerusalem. And so they're very, very, very special. And they deserve somehow $100 million. I don't know how you make that case, but the piece I wrote in the New York Times is about this idea of these great men who save companies or make them rich, and somehow their greatness, which is unique and somehow, again, almost divinely ordained or anointed, deserve the kind of salaries we pay. I do think that's a less acknowledged but still important aspect. And then there's a third aspect, and this cannot be overlooked. And this has to do with how we pay CEOs. A lot of the money that CEOs are making isn't principally in cash. It's in stock or more likely stock options. So this was not true 30 years ago. We now have a system where the gas tank of compensation has everything to do with the casinos on Wall Street and with what happens there. And so you have executives now, believe it or not, and this makes complete sense. It's not surprising, running companies at some very important level, at lots and lots of ways, so that they can ensure that the stock price, particularly aspects of the stock price that affect their own net worth, right, goes up, and that may or may not be in the best long term interests of the company, the employees, and the shareholders.
By the way, I did some math while you two were talking.
Yeah.
How long does it take Tim Cook to make as much money as the President of the United States makes, which I would argue is a pretty important job?
What, a day? 45 minutes?
One day. He makes $40,000 an hour.
Yeah.
An hour. $40,000 an hour. Go ahead.
But Nancy Kane, so prior to
See, that's what we mean. We just breathe on that. That's kind of nuts.
But prior to 1970, this was different because, I mean, the Wall Street was around in the 1950s.
Yeah, but we primarily didn't pay the executives of major public corporations, we didn't primarily pay them through equity grants.
Okay.
Paid them through some cash bonuses and salary.
Okay. So that was the Wall Street influences what's made the difference.
Well, I think what we call pay for performance, which is pay them, but somehow the stock Mark is supposed to represent, be a good proxy for performance. That idea, which had all kinds of good intentions in it, right, has resulted in a system that is, as one of the commentators in this article by Patricia Cohen says, one of my colleagues at the Business School says, is absurd.
So is that, what is anybody doing? I mean, Dan Price is an outlier, and with all due respect to him, I think it's great what he did. It's courageous. It's self-sacrificing. Maybe a couple of outliers are going to say, well, this is going to have an effect on me. My guess is the 350-1 ratio is either going to hold or go up to 400-1 in the next couple of years. Who's taking a look at this in any other than rhetorical fashion? Anybody? Members of Congress? A group of CEOs?
So one of the things that came out of some of the Dodd-Frank legislation was the SEC's, I'm not sure if it's a regulation requirement.
No, it's a statutory obligation to disclose the ratios between the CEO and their average worker to the public. It was passed in 2010. Do you know how many times they've released it? Zero. Not once.
I was going to say, thank you, Councillor Browdy. Thank you. And it doesn't seem to have had much effect. So I don't know. I mean, you have some of the Republican candidates and commentators from the right now talking about income inequality.
Yes, you do.
We can't get income inequality without getting at the runaway train of CEO and chief top executive comp. We simply cannot do it as a society, as a group of, Lincoln would say, as a group of our fellow citizens. We simply cannot do it. So this is a bomb. It is a ticking explosive, and it's very, very important. And I think that Dan Price may indeed have some selfish reasons here, or self-interested reasons. Selfish may be the wrong word, including, you know, he wants loyal employees, as Dan Maney in Forbes argues in a piece that says, look at all the good things that Dan Price gets out of this. As Dave Maney says, you know, if he gets loyal employees that deliver great service, he can ramp up the net worth of this company. At some point, he may sell it or harvest it in some other way, and he, as one of the two shareholders, makes more money. So this is arguably, as Morley Safer was saying to the head of Malden Mills, maybe very, very good business. And I don't think that in any way takes away from what he's doing. If anything, it suggests that there are different ways to skin the cat of profitability and long-term competitive success. But I think that I don't think it's – I agree with you, Jim. I don't think this is going to move the needle.
Oh, you know, maybe I'm being ridiculously optimistic.
Be
here.
Optimistic. I hope you're right.
I do think that this has – everybody denigrated Occupy Wall Street. I've said this a million times. They did nothing. What a bunch of losers. Well, I think they've changed the conversation. They've changed the conversation to the degree, as you just said, Nancy Kane, that Republican candidates are now talking about income inequality. Hillary Clinton seems to have morphed into Elizabeth Warren as she goes around the country talking about the middle class getting hammered. So and when people – I think – people, despite what the whole thing about Kansas, what's the matter with Kansas, people voting against their own self-interest, this is the Gilded Age, too.
Mm-hmm.
And
no question.
I think as between college costs and mortgages and wage stagnation and people even talking about, you know, the Pulitzer Prize today was won by the Boston Globe editorial writer who talked about people in the service industry, waiters and waitresses, getting shafted because of the tipping industry. I mean, it's dawning on people that the middle class is indeed getting the shaft. And I think once you get enough people convinced of that, then the political candidates will cater to that, and there will be something, I hope, more than lip service.
God, from your lips to God's ears.
Well, maybe I'm being crazy.
I'm not sure. I mean, it's interesting. So I was reading the business section of the Times day before yesterday. I believe it was Sunday. It might have been yesterday. Excuse me. And there's a one of the reporters for the Times is taking on Alec Baldwin, who wrote a series of sharky, I believe it's a series, a couple of sharky tweets, notes on Twitter, about protesting McDonald's and other fast food workers in Columbus Circle and New York City. And he was upset because traffic was getting snarled. And the reporter just pastes him. I mean,
he's Marjorie's guy.
She shreds him up. And then, you know, grabs the Elmer's glue and, like, wipes the pieces all, pastes them all over the wall. And her point was, this is how things change. And it got me to just sitting there thinking. I was thinking about what happened in North Carolina. I was thinking about Ferguson. I was thinking about Occupy Wall Street. I was thinking about this gathering, you know, the kindling that's starting to catch some fire around fast food workers. And I think it's in Walmart jumping on that we're going to raise wages. And, you know, there is something happening from the ground up that's very, very interesting. And a lot of it is around race and income inequality,
yes,
or race and the American dream. Both of those are integrally related in what are we as a country and what do we want to be and what are we supposed to be. It's very interesting. They're just kindling right now, but we could have a very interesting bonfire on our hands over the next 3 to 5 years. And it'll be very interesting in the wake of the presidential election and the circus that will be Iowa and New Hampshire for the next few months.
Even Mitt Romney in his brief abortive campaign was talking about income inequality, remember?
Yeah, I understand. He's talking about how he was going to sort of a war on poverty.
Part two was this thing.
I think he went to Mississippi. But, you know, get back, just we only have a minute left, get back to the thing Nancy and I were just discussing. Congress can't even force the Securities and Exchange Commission to implement a law that is already passed.
You have to give up on Congress. It's going to come out of the cities and it's going to come out of the states.
Yeah.
That's where social change is going to come from now.
And the streets.
That's right. Forget about it, Jim.
Okay, I've forgotten. But this Dan Price, I mean, the bottom line is even if there's no impact for this fleeting moment, there is somebody who stood up to this. And by the way, even if there is self-interest and even if he benefits from it, then good for him. Let him benefit from having done it. And by the way, the beautiful part of this, which we didn't play, virtually none of his employees knew this was coming. I don't know if you've heard the quotes.
They were beside themselves.
They can't pay their rent. They can't pay their medical bills.
Actually.
And all of a sudden, their salaries
And they're never leaving. And applications for job slots at Gravity
up tenfold.
Are way up.
I know. It's great.
And not to mention the great PR. I mean, who'd ever heard of this guy? Yeah. Suddenly, everybody in America knows him. Nancy Kane, thank you very much for coming in. Nancy Kane is an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robeson Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Thank you guys for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Please tune in tomorrow. We've got the writer T.C. Boyle is here. Medical ethicist Art Kaplan, he's always fun, is going to be here. Our show is a production of WGBH. Our production team, Chelsea Mers, Will Roslip, Amanda McGowan, Catherine Whalen. Our engineer is John Parker. Want to tell me what you're doing tonight on TV, Jim?
A lot of lawyers talking about, including a former U.S. attorney, day one of the penalty phase in the Tsarnaev case.
I'm Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browdy.
Thanks for listening. Please listen tomorrow.